Quicker than usual.
I warned you not to make it too strong. We mustn't damage the tissue.
You needn't worry. There will be no remembrances. The portions are exact to take in right through the election.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5:15, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 11th of April 2025. Sorry for the delay, sound card didn't work. We're streaming live from a corner of freedom close by the centre of Bristol, which is another Templar Port, basically, in Tampon Charlie's Empire of Lies. Been quite nice this week having him out of the country, hasn't it? We are live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, the DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure, our Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. So if you want the app, the latest version, just go to the show page this week, .org.uk, just under the big green blob saying download. You'll find a link to the app developers page, which has got all the latest links to the latest versions of it. So we have to go round the system, because of course the system is designed for the lazy people that think that they don't have to think for themselves, and we don't do that. Thank you very much. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, psychological warfare, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions. And occasionally, as we're going to be hearing this week, absolutely brilliant documentaries from time to time on the mainstream press. There's still some decent people ploughing away in there. Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, mostly, though. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentiers. Against World War III, or wage slavery. We'll be hearing a lot about wage slavery this evening in the Fourth Reich. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the Armageddonist, accelerationist policies are crafted to make every crisis worse, and hopefully in the future, they think, culminate in a multi-crisis, a mega multi-dimensional crisis, which they hope to control. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI. Or dead, maybe. Albert Pike's World War III relies on blind obedience, folks. But meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King, Tampon Charlie, the vampire queen Carl Miller, wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves, with the help, like the jab, of course, of a doctor. But anyway, it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the Fourth Reich, the WEF's Fourth Reich Industrial Revolution, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, Martin, we spent a long time last week, didn't we, looking at the local issues and the livable neighbourhoods, looking at this sort of idea that disabled people aren't going to be able to get out and about from their own homes, blocked in, people living in a tower block who have to break the law in order to drive out of their tower block. They can drive in, but they're not allowed to drive out. It's a one-way street now. I mean, I was driving around that part of the city, massive traffic jams everywhere around it because people can no longer drive through there.
Well, yes, I mean, we discussed this all last week, as you say.
So I think maybe we should spend a little bit less on Bristol politics this week, but we do have quite an amazing... we've got some amazing... Who would you say is our most amazing MP?
MP?
Yeah.
For Bristol?
Well, he's done pretty well for himself, hasn't he?
Well, no, you're talking about...
Darren Jones, of course.
Darren
Chief
Jones.
Chief Secretary
he's
to the...
He's definitely the most high-ranking of our local MPs.
He is, yeah. He's shot to stardom from Lawrence Weston, which is actually quite a poor area in the city. So is he evidence of social mobility?
He would say so.
What do you say?
Well, he's obviously... He's got a very humble background and he's very brainy. And that's why he's been promoted so quickly. But, of course, he's part of the new Labour establishment, which are fumbling... the ball as we speak.
Right, so you don't think he's been put in that job just because he's pliable?
Well, he's pliable to the new Labour project, that's what, you know, he's a safe pair of hands from that point of view.
He's pliable to BlackRock then?
Well, indirectly, absolutely, yeah.
So anyway, let's have a listen to Darren. This is our little look at local politics this week.
So there is this pressure in the city where people who are from here and grew up here and live here can't really afford to anymore. And that, you know, drives a lot of challenges. So we're coming into Henacre Road now. This is where I grew up. And let's see if we can find some parking spaces. It hasn't changed at all. These are the flats I grew up in. Henacre Road is the road that goes all the way around here. Yeah, you can see the sign there, says L Dub. That's the kind of slang name for Lawrence Weston, L Dub, that people know. I think everybody wants change. Do they believe it's possible? I think that's more contested. I have so many memories of growing up here as a kid. So we shouldn't look in, but that was my bedroom in the flat there. This is the kitchen. There was a great sense of community here. Everybody knew each other. And, you know, generations of my family have lived in this area. So I grew up here, obviously, with my mum and dad. My nan used to live in a council house up the hill there. My nan and granddad lived in another council house down the road there. My uncle used to live upstairs from us. So it was a very kind of close-knit community. And this is, you know, where we were all from. I had a great time growing up here. You know, there were difficult moments, and you sense the, you know, the difficulty of getting by day to day. But we had a roof over our heads, which is more than many people can say these days. I felt like I had a sense of happiness here. People will often say to me, oh, you know, difficult upbringing, you know, haven't you done well? And I get deeply frustrated that people assume that just because you're from here, you can't achieve certain things in life. Kids here are perfectly capable of doing it if they get given the opportunity to do it.
So that's, I don't know if you managed to survive that, dear listener, but it's pretty torturous. The piano tinkling away in the background is designed to make you emotional and think, oh, isn't he a nice chap? But he's really rather hamming this up, isn't he? Because what he's doing, actually, at the Treasury, is making things far worse for the people from areas like Lawrence Weston, whilst he's talking about how, say, a young person growing up there can make it big, just like he's done.
Well, was that some kind of party political broadcast or something?
Okay. Well, it's on his social media channels. He's put out recently. It's about what kind of person is Dan. Let's get to know him, you know.
Well, I mean...
Not Dan. Darren. Yeah, Dan's the other one.
I would say he's no more nor less cheesy than most mainstream politicians.
Well, what's happened to politics to allow MPs to get away with cheese like that?
It's look at the United States of America, Tony. You'll see that it's all cheese. Double cheese, treble cheese.
Well, I don't think Trump is cheese, is he? No,
it is,
he's not.
Cheese,
he's not.
Tony.
He's not. He's certainly not like that at all.
What about J.D. Vance, who grew up as a hillbilly?
Well, there is a bit of that. That's true. Yeah, that's not Trump, though, is it?
Billionaire.
That's not Trump, though, is it?
Well, Trump's...
The hillbilly stuff, you're quite right,
yeah. Trump's one of the people, except his father was a millionaire as well.
No, he's not saying he's one of the people. He's just...
Darren Jones's dad was not a millionaire or a billionaire.
Trump is just talking about changing... In fact, he's talking about an end to globalisation, isn't he, this week and last week. Is that happening or not?
Well, we could get into that later on when we get to the economics.
We can get into it now.
All right, let's get into it now. What he's doing is he's ripped down the whole of the international financial structure as created since 1945 and reorganised in 1971.
And you're always complaining about that and saying it's actually all in bias of the United States, and he's now ripping it down.
That's right, so it's good, and the Chinese are going to win the ongoing war, but it'll put everybody in America and Britain out of work. That's what's going to happen.
Why?
Because what's happening now, I don't know what you saw in the stock markets, Tony, they've been going down and down, and at a certain point, the derivatives bomb is going to go off, which is why this week...
Well, isn't that why Trump has now reined back?
That's why he's reined back, because it was about to go off. But, of course, it's still going to go off, because once you've actually messed it all up, the boat is now
wobbled. So who's
in
charge? Is it politicians or markets and bankers?
Markets, bankers, and the deep state, and the Israelis, of course, who want a war with Iran. That really will destroy the global economy. The Chinese and the Russians will probably be able to ride it out. We won't.
What will happen to fuel bills if Trump gets his war with Iran?
They'll go through the roof, of course. And the stock markets will collapse, and there will be a massive financial crisis.
He's been talking about direct talks with Iran this week, though.
Yes, but he's just saying you've got to surrender everything, otherwise we're going to bomb you, because that's the position. That's his position.
So what about our real boss, that is King Charles, I call Tampon Charlie. What do you make of him? He's had his wedding anniversary this week, hasn't he? And I did notice that there were a few people who were talking about the fact that his mum didn't come. And in fact, he didn't get married per se. He had a civil service, didn't he? A civil ceremony. He didn't actually get married in church because the Church of England said because he caused the divorce with Diana, he wasn't allowed to. It's yes. A very old-fashioned system
so we're for the royal family. To the ridiculous. We're talking about the global economy crashing. We're talking about war. And now we're talking about whether people get married in church or not.
Well, we're talking about Charlie. Yes. And he's had his wedding anniversary
this week. So why have
we gone
to Charlie from Darren via Trump?
Well, we're talking about Charlie because okay, he's in Italy. He's in charge. He's the head of state. Trump's the head of state in America, Martin.
Yes, but I
mean, Martin, is it that you don't want to talk about Charlie or
let's talk about him, but you're obsessed with him.
I'm not obsessed with him.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. He's the head of state. This is a politics show.
Okay. Well, you know what I think about him. I don't want him to be the head of state. I want to...
Well, so what's he doing in Italy, first of all? Because that's interesting,
isn't
it?
Because he's been invited, and it's to do with Britain's relationship with foreign countries. And as the head of state, he goes to visit foreign countries, because that's what...
So it's nothing to do with the fact that the Italians have been the main people pushing back against the Ukraine war and NATO going into Ukraine then?
Well, it may be that the Foreign Office, who will have planned all of this and thought in those terms, that maybe he can talk them into being more enthusiastic for Sir Keir's desire to go to war with Russia. Maybe so.
I thought it was quite interesting, of course. Do you think the Pope's got any power or not? You don't,
No, the Pope has still got quite a lot of soft power. And therefore, you know, the position the Pope takes on things like Ukraine is still matters.
Because the Pope didn't really want to see him, but then he got a private audience with Charlie.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, you know, he's the head of the Church of England, so he's going to demand... But, of course, the Pope's not very well. He hasn't been seeing anybody.
Well, that's why he didn't want to see him. He didn't really want to see him.
I mean, if you're feeling very ill in hospital, do you want Prince Charles to visit you?
The last person in the world.
I don't think I would.
Actually, what happens, of course, in the way of these photo calls, every time there's a disaster, people are lying in their beds feeling really sick. And who comes in with the TV cameras? Tampon Charlie. They've been doing this for years, Martin, haven't they, the royal family, to sort of PR up their message?
Well, of course. I mean, they are, you know, they're all PR, aren't they? I mean, that's all they do, apart from being fantastically wealthy and owning all sorts of things we don't know anything about. So, I mean, their PR either works or it doesn't, you know. Sometimes they get obviously it works for some people, and for other people it just it doesn't.
You are usually a very good judge of these things, so let's see if you think King Charles's PR over in the Italian Parliament as he was speaking this week worked or not.
Today, sadly, the echoes of those times, which we fervently hoped had been consigned to history, reverberate across our continent.
He's talking about World War II.
Our younger generations can now see in the news every day on their smartphones and tablets that peace is never to be taken for granted. Britain and Italy stand today united in defence of the democratic values we share. Our countries have both stood by Ukraine in her hour of need and welcomed many thousands of Ukrainians requiring shelter. Our armed forces stand side by side in NATO. We are grateful beyond measure for the role Italy plays in hosting key NATO bases and taking a leading role in so many overseas operations. Just a few weeks' time, the Royal Navy's carrier strike group, led by the aircraft carrier HMS Prince of Wales, will exercise alongside Italian forces in the Mediterranean, a powerful symbol of our cooperation. So too is our project to build our next generation fighter aircraft together through the Global Combat Air Programme. Alongside Japan. It will generate thousands of jobs in our countries and speaks volumes about the trust we place in each other. We work closely together in the G7, as we did during your G7 presidency last year, whose ministerial meetings set a new record for energy and activism. Just as we stand together in defense of our values, so too we stand together in defense of our planet. From the droughts in Sicily to the floods in Somerset, both our countries are already seeing the ever more damaging effects of climate change. The last time I spoke in this Parliament building was to a special meeting devoted to climate change. I could hardly believe it is 16 years ago now. So, I hope you will forgive me for saying that the warnings I offered then about the urgency of the climate challenge are depressingly being borne out by events. Extreme storms, normally seen once in a generation, now characterize every year. Countless precious plant and animal species face extinction in our lifetimes. So much is at stake. Italy's own natural heritage is blessed with extraordinary riches. Indeed, Italy remains home to the highest number of animal species in Europe. Perhaps Rome's greatest poet, Virgil, understood profoundly the respect that was due to nature. He was, it might be said, the father of sustainable farming, a cause I have supported my whole life. In his Georgics, he spoke about respecting the natural cycles of the land, the importance of pollination by bees, soil conservation, and even the value of composting and organic matter. For example, this from a well-known Italian translation of Book One.
Okay, so I'll tell you what, we'll spare you the Virgil read by King Charles in Italian. But Martin, what do you think? Do you think this convinces the stuff about compost is going to be resonate in Italy?
Well, I mean, it's not new that he goes on about these things. I think more to the point was the first bit where he's talking about the war in the Ukraine and all of that. Some of that speech undoubtedly will have been written by the Foreign Office. And then he'll have been allowed to extemporise a bit at the end about the stuff he wants to extemporise about. So there you have it. Whether it impressed anybody, I very much
can't. This is what PR is supposed to be, isn't it? But he seems to me as if he's almost talking to himself, and he's abusing that sort of platform to say the things that he wants to say, because it gives him a voice around the world, and it sort of echoes around. But he's actually equating, in a lot of ways, he's equating climate and war as the two great, terrible, great dooms which are afflicting us. But he doesn't really seem to have much in the way of solution.
Well,
I mean, for example, with the Ukraine war, he could say, for example, well, we're not interested in putting British troops into Ukraine. But, of course, they are. This thing that they've announced this week called the Reassurance Force.
The Italians aren't.
No.
So that's why he's
saying French,
it.
And the French are, it looks like, but the British are not.
No, the British are. We're the most in favour of all. And everybody else is going, oh, I don't know about that.
Have you seen the Russians saying that the British are actually planning to go into Odessa very soon, in the next couple of weeks, and stay there for 5 years? So has Charles decided that, or did the Houses of Parliament?
No, it's not that. Who will have decided that is the British deep state. The politicians are lined up with the deep state, and he's part of the deep state, so he's lined up.
Tugendhat and people like
this. They're all lined up. Very few people in Britain are opposed to the ludicrous policy we've pursued in the Ukraine since 2014.
Well, the public, you mean? Or you mean the elite?
Well, I mean, even in the public, of course, the public have been bombarded with a diet of nonsense, and many of them believe that diet of nonsense.
Well, one of these days we should do this. You and I will stand out in the street and we'll just have a clipboard and say, would you like to sign up to fight the Russians?
Well, nobody. There's a huge gap between Britain's belligerent attitudes and the willingness of individuals to actually do anything. We're all in favour of wars against foreign countries a long way away, which we can watch on the telly. Of course, real wars, like the IRA planting a bomb at the end of your road, not so much. But there you are. That's the Brits for you.
So you don't like the Brits, do you?
No, I am a Brit. Yeah, but I therefore feel entitled to criticise.
Yeah, well, that's of course you're entitled. In fact, we love criticising, and that's one of the things
means,
the Brits.
Certainly.
I totally agree with you. And in fact, I think the British are some of the most anti-establishment people you'll find.
Well, they are, and they aren't.
The yeah, Britain, they are.
We're a contradictory beast.
I'm not saying most people are anti-establishment, but we've got a kind of healthy anti-establishment view in this country where, look, the establishment, if it gets on top of you, it needs to be elbowed out the way.
Well, that's in theory. Is the case
whether
in
you
all
can actually
supposedly
do
democratic
it.
Countries.
I mean, I think it's possibly because we grew up, our generation in the 70s and 80s, grew up with a tremendous amount of satire, which resonated very well about the church, about the government, about particularly about Thatcher and things like that. But anyway, when it comes to Tampon Charlie, I really like to drill into some of his real ideas, get into his head, because I think he has a completely different persona inside there than we see on the outside. He's trying to be nice about nature and this kind of thing. Well, anyway, so he was one of the, in fact, he was the patron for many decades of the Soil Association. And I did an interview with a website called Farming Explained, Ollie Fletcher, who's a farmer in Leicestershire for many generations of farm. They've been farming there. I did that the other day. In fact, I think it was published last weekend. Should we redistribute land? Do you want to just answer that question, Martin? Should we redistribute land?
In general, the answer's got to be yes.
Oh, good. I agree with you. Totally. We agree on something for a change. Yeah, he's done a very interesting history of the organic movement, and I had no idea. I mean, if you think about Bertrand Russell and people like that in Britain, these people were eugenicists, and fascists were very much part of the original organic movement in the UK. I had no idea. He's done a superb job on this. Let's have a listen to him.
I was disheartened to see the Soil Association's selective account of its own history. This is the history section on their website. They established Lady Balfour as the founder and a pioneer. She wasn't the sole founder or a pioneer in any sense. The philosophy came to her from William Sanderson through Lymington. I think the hope is that by implying it was a new idea starting with her, perhaps you won't investigate that. The other founders don't get a mention, Rolf Gardiner, Dorian Jenks, Lymington. But the Soil Association really love Lady Balfour. I think this is because they've decided that having a female historical figure makes them look progressive rather than threatening. But is it progressive if she was a fascist? They don't mention the fascism in the short biography they have on their website, even though it's the whole reason their association was founded. Instead, they tell us that Lady Eve housed Jewish refugees during the war, which, although commendable, I'm sure you'll agree is a footnote in her life story and a strange detail to include when compared to the suspicious failure to mention her political leanings. I think these refugees have been mentioned on the presumption that anti-Semitism and fascism are one and the same in the public imagination, so if she's not an anti-Semite, people will assume she wasn't a fascist. But she was a fascist, and the Soil Association, when she was a member, was a fascist organisation. Dorian Jenks used the journal Mother Earth to keep the spirit alive. He sent his work to Derry. Most, if not all, of the people from Kinship in Husbandry were involved with the Soil Association in some form. We should be sceptical about organisations that deliberately hide someone's fascist ideology in order to say that they were really cool. Especially when they say things like this. We are proud to uphold Lady Eve's values. I find this quite concerning. Great Lives on BBC Radio 4 discussed Balfour's life story, and in it, two people who should know better get egg on their face by talking about how wonderful she was without at any point mentioning that she was a fascist. They claim that she founded the movement with her book.
What was the central idea behind the book?
The central message was that the health of soil, plants, animals and people is one and indivisible. And, of course, that idea gave birth to the development of the what we now know today as the organic movement.
The movement didn't start in 1943, did it?
What is it about Eve that got you personally so hooked?
I mean, hooked is probably the right word. I confess a borderline obsession with her.
Obsessed with a fascist? That's not a good look.
She really was so ahead of her time.
Ahead of her time? She believed in feudalism. I really hope she wasn't ahead of her time.
I think the thing that Lady Eve did was she challenged an orthodoxy, and she was up against the resistance of the people who'd been linked throughout their professional lives and their farming lives to the old order.
The old order. She was an aristocrat. What other old order is there? I've established the reason people didn't listen to her. She was a fascist who spouted anti-scientific nonsense. But because these people are erasing that from history, they have to come up with a reason her ideas are only really gaining traction now, in the last decade or so. Why didn't people listen to her at the time? And they pulled the misogyny card, which I think is particularly cheap, given all of the male supporters of organicism were also ignored and continue to be hidden by the Soil Association itself. They have chosen not to make this about Lymington or Jorian Jenks or Rolf Gardiner, all of whom I think made much greater ideological contributions than Balfour did. But if they make it about Lady Eve, they can say this.
I think it would be naive to say that there wasn't some misogyny that came into this as well.
I repeat, that radio programme featured two educated people involved in the movement, one of whom wrote this book. And they were in conversation with a presenter on a public broadcasting service, the BBC, and at no point does anybody mention that this woman was a fascist. You can't be obsessed with someone, her words, and not know that they were a fascist. This is being actively swept under the rug by people who want to promote the ideas that Lady Balfour dreamt up with her fascist friends that you never hear about. We should see this for what it is. The organic movement was never intended to fight climate change. It was a political movement. But today, they are trying to exploit fear of climate change to force conformity to their ideas. But it still means starving people. They get a free pass a lot of the time because people think they're pro-nature and they're a charity. They're not capitalists, so they're the good guys. But they're not the good guys, are they? They're the opposite of that.
Quite right too, Ollie Fletcher. Love you, mate. So absolutely brilliant little incisive look into the origins of the Soil Association, Lady Eve Balfour and people like this. And then also the BBC's whitewash of their links to fascism, Martin.
Well, it's an interesting little historical byway, isn't it? I was vaguely aware of these things, but obviously this guy, Ollie Fletcher, is it? Has investigated
Farming
it more
Explained,
thoroughly than I have.
Farming Explained is his YouTube channel, and you'll even find me on there talking about redistribution of land, bizarrely. And he started, it's actually rather funny, and I laughed when I saw the record, because he picked out something, he said, oh, so do you want to be a peasant then? I thought this is quite an annoying way of interviewing me, but I love it because I don't mind people taking the mickey out of me, as he was doing a little bit there, because the point is we get actually learn from being pushed and being challenged, and you don't learn in by listening to things like that BBC interview there, where that's all they're talking about is without the most important elephant in the room, which is these people are fascists. So, Martin, I mentioned Dan when I was trying to talk about Darren Jones, but this is pretty shocking, isn't it, to have our local MP who took over from Jacob Rees-Mogg from the Labour Party, North East Somerset, I think it was, and also he's our Metro Mayor at the same time, so he's moonlighting with two jobs, arrested this week for rape and for child abuse. So does that surprise you?
Well, I mean, given that we know that these things go on at every social level, it doesn't surprise me. But at the same time, we got to wait. You know, people have got to have their day in court and all the rest of it. We'll have to see, won't we?
What about the timing?
Well, the timing, I don't think there's anything particularly suspicious about the timing.
Oh, yes, there is.
Why is there suspicious about the timing?
Because last week, I'm sure you were paying attention, we had all those interviews with all of the candidates for the Metro Mayor. So yeah. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 candidates, including Reform Party UK. Is it 6 maybe? And we heard from all of them last week. So the same, literally, within a couple of days of the launch of the campaign for the vote at the beginning of May for the next Metro Mayor, suddenly it's announced that this guy is being arrested for all these crimes. So this, it seems to me that they think it's a bit inconvenient to arrest a sitting Metro Mayor, an assisting MP, so they're waiting until his time is up as Metro Mayor before arresting the guy. And they're probably sitting on these allegations for many years.
Well, maybe, but it's also more likely, if you're going to think of it in terms of suspicious timing, is it's a way to mess up the Labour Party's candidacy for Metro Mayor, because obviously this is going to badly reflect on them if he's accused. And, of course, by the time they vote, in early May, that won't be resolved one way or the other. It'll just be hanging over him and therefore over the Labour Party. So you could say that the police there are trying to sabotage the Labour Party if there is a conspiracy.
Yeah, it could be. So do you think it's right that they have announced that, that he's been questioned on these offences? I mean, he's not been found guilty or anything, has he?
I think they are the police.
I'm not sure if they've even charged him at all, actually. He's been suspended from the Labour Party. Far as I can see, he's been arrested on suspicion of rape and child sex offence, but he's not been charged.
Well, I haven't followed the case very closely, Tony.
What's the significance if he hasn't been charged, as it
seems? Well, if he hasn't been charged, then really there's an awful lot of hot air here, isn't it? If he's not been charged, what are we talking about?
No, well, I agree. If
he's done something, charge him. Yeah. If he hasn't done something, well, don't charge him, but don't say we're investigating blah, 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 but he's not been charged with anything.
Yeah. Well, there is a danger, isn't there, that policing could get a bit political, actually, and that the police could intervene in the democratic process.
Well, that's the suspicion here, is if there's any skullduggery, it's a way of trying to fix the election result. But I suspect it probably is just a series of coincidences. But there you are, you never know.
OK, so also we've had a junior MP arrested in the Labour Party up in Westminster. Have you seen that one, Martin?
No.
Again, it's for child abuse of some sort. Do you think there's more child sexual abuse within Labour candidates, Labour MPs, than there is in the Tory party, or is it around about the same?
Basically, there's far more of this stuff goes on than most people realise at every social level. Let me just stress that. And, we shouldn't be surprised by anything, really.
What about, there was a speaker actually at the UK Column Conference last weekend, he was suggesting that Muslim gangs, grooming gangs, are by far the worst, and but most of the rape and sexual abuse is happening through them, and they're the ones that are being left alone because they're Muslims.
Well, that's the sort of thing he would say, but the stats seem to suggest that that's not the case, that in actual fact, people who are arrested and convicted, it's a pretty close spread to the actual spread of the population. So there's no more Muslim grooming gangs than there are white grooming
gangs. So why would someone be there at the UK Column Conference in Cheltenham saying that actually we need to put... In fact, he himself was an Asian guy saying that we should be pointing the finger at Muslims here, actually.
Well, because there's a political axe to grind here, Tony, isn't there? Everybody wants to put the blame for other people on stuff like this and make them look bad. That's why Epstein and Mossad got all that information and all those top people, including Trump, for example, having sex with underage girls, so they can blackmail them. Okay, that's the King Cora Boys Home scandal. That was MI5, who were presumably white gay men, I presume, who actually organised all of the sexual abuse there. The state did it, paid for by our taxes, in order to try and control the situation in Northern Ireland. And boys from Northern Ireland, from the King Cora Boys Home, were then prostituted out to blackmail people on this side of the Irish Sea. Now, that is the big scandal, is all of that top-level paedophile blackmail stuff. And, of course, it has political implications for controlling the political process. Muslim grooming gangs picking up on kids coming out of care who are basically thrown on the scrap heap because of the way we run this country. That is a big social problem. Stepfathers are a massive social problem, Tony. Loads and loads of people grow up in a household where the male in the house isn't, in fact, their biological father.
Well, what about the female? What about the female?
Well, it's mostly blokes who do this stuff. Not entirely, but mostly. Yeah. Because it's the testosterone, Tony.
Yes. You know, and it's a lack of self-control. It's the weakness in the modern world. There was a speaker at the conference at Cheltenham of the UK Column called Rajamir. That's Rajamiah. First time I come across him. He's saying there's a disproportionate representation of Pakistani men in the UK abusing white girls, and there has been for decades.
Well, he can say that, and I would say that if you actually look at the stats, that's not true. In fact,
why might someone be saying that on the UK column?
Because everybody has got an axe to grind about this. Some people don't like Muslims at all, Tony. The fact is they don't want them to be here at all. Yeah? and so they can find ways to demonise them.
Like the Israelis, they don't like Muslims. In fact, they like to demonise Muslims in countries that they want to support them in their genocide, don't
they? That's right. So, Martin, in other words, you've got to take all of this stuff. That doesn't mean that there aren't bad Muslim guys out there doing bad stuff. Definitely there are. But they're not the only people doing it. As I said, quite normal inverted commas, stepdads. Most children are abused by step-parents. Hundreds of kids die every year in this country. They're killed by their carers. Not by strangers, by their carers.
So is there going to be a proper inquiry into child sex abuse covered up by Labour politicians in northern cities that have been actually involved themselves in that abuse? Are we going to allow these councils just to mark their own homework? Because Jess Phillips seems to think that's fine. We haven't got enough money to look into this.
Well, we should be looking into what MI5 did at Kinkora.
We shouldn't be looking into
there's already been an
cover-ups.
There's already been an inquiry into what went on.
Yeah, they didn't find anyone in the police or in the local authority had committed any offences.
So what if we spend millions on having another inquiry, what do you think they're going to discover?
Well, all of these people want to give evidence and you don't want them to.
I'm not saying that, Tony. I'm just saying there's already been an inquiry, and if you're going to have another one, you've got to make a case for it. If you've got some prosecution...
Well, I just did make a case, made a case not to have one.
No.
Like Labour.
Yes, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with that. It depends, doesn't it? When Kemi Badenoch was going on about this in the House of Commons, as Keir Starmer said, we've already had an inquiry, why would another inquiry, which will no doubt be conducted in the same way as the last inquiry, why do you think that would make any difference? What we probably need to do is look, the woman who led the first inquiry said,
you know what's happened with Hillsborough? Over the years, there have been several inquiries, I think it's five. Mm-hmm. Eventually, bit by bit, you get to the truth, but you have to keep pushing for an inquiry. You can't just say, what you said, and said, shrug your shoulders and say there's no point.
All right,
you have to ask the people who have actually been victims and survivors of these abusers.
All right. I'm not necessarily against having an inquiry, Tony. It's a question, it's a judgment call. But we need an inquiry into what happened at Kinkora so we can break MI5, so that we can disrupt it completely, smash it to pieces, send people to prison, and reconstitute the whole state. That's the sort of inquiry I want. Yeah,
you're not going to reconstitute the whole state. I think that's a bit of a tall order.
No, this is the most important.
A revolutionary. Are you a revolutionary?
What I'm saying is, if you're going to spend money on inquiries, and we've only got a limited amount of money to spend on inquiries, that's the inquiry we should have, and that's what we should be talking about as well. Kinkora Boys Home, not Muslims in Rotherham, Kinkora Boys Home. Because that was part of a war, but lots of people died.
I'd like to play you a bit of this guy speaking at the UK Column conferences. I would like to probably play you some. I mean, for example, Catherine Gunn was speaking there, and Alex Thompson, absolutely brilliant speakers. Be nice to give you a little bit of a hear of that. But you have to go through some paywall on the UK Column. Hopefully, at some point, like Ian Crane used to do with his conferences, in the next couple of weeks, they will put all these things up online for everyone to have a proper listen to. I do hope they do, because it, you know, it means that it becomes all a little bit insular if you've got to go through a paywall to watch that. But I particularly would like to hear that presentation to see what evidence there is that Muslims are in any way a larger proportion in the UK. He's talking particularly about Pakistan.
What I would say, just anecdotally, is kids who are coming out of care, many of whom are white, because it's a white community which tends to have broken families and so on, Muslims less so. And but what you've got in places like Rotherham is things like the taxi industry and the massage industry, you know, is what you might call red light district stuff. That's an interaction, yeah? And therefore temptation is there and possibly options to do things.
Yeah, and also possibly police turn a blind eye to these things.
Well, they turn a blind eye because in actual fact they turn a blind eye to anybody abusing these girls, as your friend John Wedger has pointed out, in London, because they haven't got the time, the energy, and these girls who are the victims are regarded by the whole of society as a write-off.
Well, what John was saying also was that there were senior police involved in abusing the kids.
Right.
So the people at his level... PC, detective, constable level, etc., didn't most of them just don't dare go against their bosses.
That's right, and those people aren't Muslim gangs, are they? They're senior police officers and lawyers.
Anyway, well done to John for getting the prosecutions that he did manage to do in London, and it just shows you that it can be done. It would be nice to hear from John Wedger at the UK Column Conference, and maybe there's some reason why they didn't invite him and they invited this guy instead, because he was actually at the cutting edge of these things. So, anyway, the BBC, we're always moaning about it here. Everyone's always moaning about the mainstream media. Of course, they do some good stuff, and they did some absolutely fantastic stuff this week. In fact, it's my former news editor. He became the home affairs correspondent for Points West, Steve Brody, and this week he looked into the thorny topic of Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit. I'll put a full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. This is Lloyds Bank in Bristol, in Castle Park, right in the city centre by Bristol Bridge, where Bristol was founded. And that was the old Bank of England, West of England branch, and it had a kind of almost a what do you call it, gun emplacement sort of fortress thing there, with armoured glass everywhere, and an underground place for the I suppose the banknote lorries or bullion lorries or something to go in and out, and that is now being redeveloped, written about St Mary La Porte development by Joe Banks, but it's still just about there. It's about to be demolished, and up until we had a new police and crime commissioner about 4 years ago, all this activity of the business support unit was taking place there. And then when we got a new police and crime commissioner, they put everything from there into a load of removal vans and moved it to a different part of the country. But Steve Brody's been investigating them, and he did a, I thought, excellent, brilliant, literally fantastic panorama on Monday this week. Let's have a listen and an excerpt from that now.
In Cardiff, Kashif was struggling to get his case investigated. In 2019, he submitted a 40-page bundle of documents to police.
What happened next is really surprising, because Avon Somerset police immediately tried to restrict the scope.
The force agreed to look at just two documents.
This raised alarm bells. I sent a subject access request to Lloyds Bank. A subject access request is a request for all documentation pertaining to a bank customer.
The documents he got back surprised him.
We found an email which confirmed that Lloyds Bank had prior knowledge of the meeting that I was supposed to have with Avon Somerset Police even before it had taken place. It also said that they were going to close my case with no further action.
The trouble was, Kashif had been promised a further review of his case at that very meeting. He made a complaint of police corruption.
I got a text message that evening, nearly at midnight, from the Chief Constable of Avon Somerset Police, saying that could I possibly come in for a meeting the very next morning.
Kashif was told by the Chief Constable the force had referred itself to the Independent Office for Police Conduct, the IOPC. The watchdog found undocumented contact between Lloyds and the police, including calls and emails which it says were not recoverable.
There was an active back channel between Adrian White, the chief operating officer, and Dr. Kirsty Cogram, who was the head of complex crime. We now know that they had regular telephone contact.
The IOPC upheld part of Kashif's complaint. It found the evidence strongly suggested standards of professional behaviour had been breached when information about Kashif was shared with the bank with no apparent policing purpose. And as a result, there had been a significant loss of trust between Kashif and the police. But the IOPC said it found no evidence to suggest corruption.
Well, that's just one of the cases that Steve looks at in this report on the business support unit's relationship with Avon and Somerset Police, Martin. This is wrong on so many different levels. The idea is when you go to the police with evidence of crime, that you will not do that if you think that maybe the police will take that evidence to the person you're accusing. And that's exactly what they've done here. They've got an active back channel with the people committing the crime right the way through.
Well, I can't remember that much about this case, apart from the fact that they were, you know, the business support unit was basically cheating people out of their businesses, wasn't it?
So what they were doing basically was saying, well, we're going to help you with your business because you're having a bit of problems paying back your loan. And they would start to increase interest rates, say that you were moving you into a special account, and slowly but surely they would strangle the business, take it over, and take hold of all of your assets.
Yes, and therefore, you know, this is white-collar crime, and obviously if you're white-collar criminals, having the police paid off is going to be jolly useful.
Well, I mean,
isn't it?
I spoke to Martin Walls over many years ago, and he's a merchant seaman who he used to run. If you go down to Weston-super-Mare, Knightstone Island, I don't know if anyone here knows Weston, in fact you could even do it on Google Earth probably, you'll see his boat, his ship, not moored to Knightstone Island, and it's just off, it's literally a part of Weston along the seafront, and it's been sitting there for years because Lloyd's destroyed his business, and they did exactly to him what they did to this chap. But I mean, the idea that if these people will not go to the police, Martin, if they think that the police are in bed with the criminals, in this case Lloyd's Bank, but it doesn't matter. If you say, I think someone down the road has been murdered, and you give that information to the police, and then they, rather than investigate it dispassionately and professionally, they go to the murderer and say, oh, this guy's saying this about you, what do you think, to the murderer. The police is completely non-functional.
Well, it may be.
Well, it's worse than non-functional.
Well, it may be non-functional, as we put it, but it may also be quite functional if you've got a system in place. I mean, how do you think the Mafia run Sicily or the 'Ndrangheta run Naples? Yeah? They've got the police on the payroll, and that's normal stuff in the real world.
So is that because we don't pay our police enough, or even is it because
there are no struggle? It's an ongoing struggle, because it's going to be in the interests of organised criminals to suborn the police force. It's going to be number one on their list of things to do, isn't it?
I seem to remember also, I don't know if he's in the documentary, but Noel Edmonds was someone else who was caught by this unit. The idea is that they say, we're trying to help you. Actually, what they're trying to do is just steal all of your property off of you and say, well, actually, what we really want is the collateral for the loan, and we're not going to help you pay the loan. We're going to make sure you can't pay the loan. And the police are supposed to investigate fraud
They're not. Maybe what's underlying this and driving it is the fact that Lloyd's Bank was effectively bankrupt, and they're actually going around stealing because they've got to do that, otherwise they're going to go to prison for fraud themselves. You
or
know.
They might just go bust.
Or they'll go bust, yes.
So what is the possibility that a bank that can make money up out of nowhere could go bust? Surely it's impossible.
No, because they can't just make money up out of nowhere. Ultimately, they what they're doing...
The money they've lent to these people, they did make out of nowhere, yes, and they do make out,
yes,
out of
I know,
nowhere.
But at the same time, banks can go bust, because we know that they can go bust. In 2008, they all went bust. It just happened. And that's probably possibly what's going to happen in the very near future with all this turmoil in the international markets, is big banks. You know, when Argentina defaults, big banks in the West are going to go bust. That's what happened in the 1980s.
Well, it's not just the... I put a link up to Steve Brody's Panorama documentary, the audio for that, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But in the meantime, the context, which I always talk about at the beginning, Martin, the accelerationism, the fact that we've got all these horrendous crises, you haven't got enough money in your pocket to pay the bills. I noticed a clip popped up. You know, I think it was when we were chatting with Melissa last week, there's an excellent social media account called Ben Claimant, B-E-N Claimant. And I think he's based down in Taunton, but I've met him a few times. And he's a sort of, I suppose, trade union person. And on his account, he posted the most extraordinary thing I saw the other day, because, you know, we've had all this thing April, all the bills are going up again. And this is Sir Keir Starmer in the run-up to last year's general election, talking about what he was going to do about household bills. And I found it, he was on the Jeremy Vine show.
Your circumstances, but I doubt when you hear, you know, the energy companies and the government talking about £3,500 possibly for energy bills going up to £4,000. I suspect, like many, many other people, you shudder at that, because these are huge, huge amounts of money, which is why we say under a Labour government we'd freeze those prices. We wouldn't allow them to go up, Ella, because what you're already paying is going to go through the roof. And I don't know how you would cope with that, Ella.
This whole country's hurting at the moment.
Oh,
and whether this might be too big for you or any party to sort out.
Yeah, look, I mean,
international government.
In terms of how it's impacting on people. Obviously, part of my job is to be around the country the whole time to talk to people, and everybody's talking about this because they're really, really worried. I also, you know, when I was growing up, my dad was a toolmaker, worked in a factory, my mum was a nurse. We didn't have huge amounts of money, and I remember struggling with the bills and the telephone being cut off and things like that. So I know firsthand what it feels like to sit around the kitchen table and say, look, I just can't actually pay all this. And I know that millions of people are in that state of mind at the moment. They're worried sick. That's why I thought it was very important for us to have a very clear, simple policy. We'll freeze your bills. We won't allow that to happen. And we'll get oil and gas companies from their excess profits to pay for that freezing of the bills. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's a political choice. I think it's right that we do something about it because we can't just keep walking past this problem.
So it's the old people that are going to freeze, Martin, not the bills, isn't it? I mean, what is he talking about? He's not done anything about that. It's just a lie. Barefaced lie.
It's, you could say it's a barefaced lie. I would just say it's standard politics. And, of course, he's now got to pay the price.
So barefaced lies is standard politics in the Labour Party, isn't it?
Well, it's not just the Labour Party, Tony. It's politics in
general. Everyone
else
is doing it, so we can do it too.
That's right. Well, in actual fact, the point is that he's not
freezing
the bills, is he?
What's the point in voting if you're just voting for A, B or C bunch of liars?
Well, let's not vote at all, Tony.
You don't think there is any point. Do you vote?
No, I do vote. I do vote,
yes. Why then? You're a fool.
Oh, really?
Yes, because okay. There's no point, because everyone just lies, don't they? This is normal now, including the Labour Party, your party.
Yes. Keir Starmer basically has been... what could I say? He's been mugged by reality. It's all very well saying this before you're the Prime Minister when you get
there. Do you think
there,
he had any intention of really doing it?
I don't think even he knew.
You know what?
That's
I
the reality. That he doesn't even know what he's saying.
He
that,
could.
He's
they could.
Do it or not.
As you and I have spoken many times about this. It's very simple to renationalise these things. What you do is you just make it impossible for these private utilities to make a profit, and they have to hand the franchises back. And so why on earth does Starmer not do that?
Because that's not in the Labour manifesto,
Tony. By doing that, he could freeze those bills.
He could, and if his name was Jeremy Corbyn, he would have done exactly what you're suggesting. But Jeremy Corbyn was removed from the leadership of the Labour Party.
By people like Keir Starmer.
Yes.
Sorry, Sir Keir Starmer.
Yes, because he lost an election, then Keir Starmer won one, which is why he's in a position, because he promised the wealthy classes and the electricity and other utility companies that he wouldn't nationalise them. So... what happens is the Labour Party, a Labour regime like this one, keeps its promises to the funders and to the mainstream wealth.
To the World Economic Forum.
To the World
example,
Economic
yeah.
Forum, all the rest of it.
Actually, didn't
means,
they ask?
Because the people who vote for them.
In 23,
are
they
expendable.
Said, are you going to be doing any kind of nationalisation? And Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer promised them faithfully, no, we won't.
Except that they may have to nationalise British Steel because there's no option, and they may end up nationalising loads
so
of things.
Will they do that over the weekend, do you think?
I don't know is the answer to that.
Why do you think, because we heard last week, didn't we, that there's been massive persecution of British Steel, saying that it's not green enough, and they've been fining them massive amounts of money for every molecule of carbon that comes out of one of their chimneys. And so that's one of the reasons that they're having to close. The Chinese also have said that we are not going to order from our own steel plant. So this is, how is it that the Chinese have got hold of British Steel and they're now saying, oh, well, you're going to just have to shut this down. Do you think they'll renationalise it? So a lot of questions in one there.
Well, there's a lot of questions in one there. Well, I mean, the Chinese shouldn't be running British Steel. But then, of course, we've got lots of people.
That was Margaret Thatcher,
that's Margaret
really,
Thatcher,
wasn't it?
Thank yeah. for that. When it comes to nationalising something that's bankrupt like that, I mean, like Thames Water should be nationalised, and of course if you're nationalising something that's bankrupt, you don't have to pay for it. Because in fact what you're doing is taking on the debts. Now, it may be that you want to take those debts. I mean, it's normal, you know, Rolls-Royce was nationalised by the Tories in the 1970s, because you don't want it to go down the drain. And even if you wanted it to be in the private sector, ultimately, if you don't nationalise it now, it's going to disappear and it won't be there. All of these things need to be thought about, but they need to be thought about in a systematic way. And the new Labour leadership just imagined that they could carry on being soft Tories. we just don't, won't do the stupid stuff. We'll just stick to the conventional thinking. And that's what we, that was their pitch to the people. We're not going to overturn the establishment. We're not going to change anything very much. We're going to be steady as she goes, but we won't be stupid and incompetent.
But we will get rid of the family farms. But that's one thing we
will
do.
Don't forget the family farms.
And what's happened, by the way, what's happened with the general state of business in Britain is we've recorded our highest number of company closures for 20 years in the final corner of 2024. Yeah. Nearly 200,000 businesses were struck off the official register. Now, that's quite a lot, isn't it, going down the tubes? This is mostly family businesses, I would imagine, not the big monopolists that are being scrapped as businesses. The figure has been revealed, by the way, by research firm Beauhurst, Beauhurst. I'll put a link to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and it's published in Business Matters magazine.
Well, we're on the cusp of a recession and possibly a depression, which is going to last for a generation. Industry in Germany has been completely devastated in the last 6 months, and that's new stuff for them. So it's going to be very shocking. And of course, if the German economy goes down the drain really fast, we're going to be pulled down the drain as well. But we've got the Americans to thank for that, for blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And, of course, we've carried on with everything.
The European banksters have got nothing to do with it, then. People running the euro.
No, the European banksters are controlled by the US deep state. The European Union has been a front for the US deep state all along.
Not the other way around.
No, not the other way around, Tony. Why? The US economy was the strongest in the world recently, you know, in terms of basic finance until recently. It's all been messed up now by Trump. But, of course, it's the European economy, where we live, which is actually going to have the biggest crash here. The knocking out of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and the war, the sanctions,
why don't we
sanctions
just,
on Russia
why don't we
have destroyed
just bring,
the Western European
why don't
economy.
We just bring energy prices down? Can the government intervene to do that?
Because if you
that
do...
That will help British Steel, for
yes,
example, won't it?
Yes, but what you may have to... there's only a certain amount of energy to be passed around. So if you don't do rationing by price, you've got to do rationing by rationing, which means you can bring the price down, but that means you're only going to get 6 hours a day of electricity.
You know what I think will happen is...
That's what's going on in Ukraine now.
The people running data centres will be in the best position to bid and get that electricity, and everyone else will have to be reading with candlelight.
That's right. I mean, what's going to happen going forward is people are just going to suddenly realise that the infrastructure of daily life, which they take for granted, just ain't going to be there. Like in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, it just collapsed. And then it was a war on. And it wasn't like it used to be, where people used to go to the beach and wonder about what they were going to do for Christmas. That's what's going to happen. And people in the Western countries have been fairly lucky, but they're now going to find out what it's like to go through Russia in the 1990s, where people watch their whole lives completely smashed in front of them.
Well, one of the nice things you can do if you're in charge of these private utilities, now in national hands, is you can make sure that none of these water companies put fluoride in the water. And I was very pleased to hear this week, there was this is on Times Radio with Alan Bolton, a chap called Sir Ivan Lawrence, who's a former Tory MP, who did a thing, because they had this thing in the United States, but it was a brilliant interview, and fascinating to hear about. Do you know much about filibustering? As this guy did a great long talk in the States. He was a Democrat, and he was doing it
I'm not quite sure what it's to try and talk out a bill, isn't it? So if you keep talking and talking and talking, so nobody else can say anything, eventually the time for whatever bill it is runs out.
This
and then,
guy,
and then
Sir Ivan Lawrence, I take my hat off to him, because he was talking and talking and talking in order that this bill to allow fluoride to be put into British water was talked out of time. And Adam Bolton managed to track him down to talk to on Sunday on Times Radio.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity of establishing yet again that it was not a filibuster. I was making a point. And the point was that I was infuriated by the fact that several of the experts who gave evidence to the Commons Select Committee that was looking into preventive medicine either didn't know about, because they hadn't bothered to read, or didn't want to know about, the many university conclusions drawn worldwide, sometimes by Nobel Prize winners of integrity, that it was medically harmful to fluoridate the water by putting into it industrial effluent, and like from aluminium smelting, brick making, chemical fertilizer, in order to avoid prosecutions for polluting the air and the water and the land. And I was so irritated by that that I decided to put on the record the findings of some of these universities worldwide. And it took me a long time, particularly because I was interrupted all the time by people who had funny things to say, like Toby Jessel, who I remember said on a point of order, Mr. Speaker, does the honourable and learned gentleman aware that he promised me a lift home 3 hours ago? And Sir Bernard Brain said that I was abusing my right of free speech, because when he spoke for 3.5 hours, it was in the interests of 30,000 of his constituents. And I said, well, I've been speaking to 46 million of mine.
You didn't, however, win the day, did you?
I didn't win because I had to go off to the Old Bailey. In those days, you could be both a practicing member of Parliament and a practicing member of the bar, and I was in the middle of a very long, largest cash robbery of all time case in the Old Bay. I was in the middle of cross-examining a policeman, and after I'd been speaking for 4 hours and 20 minutes, my alarm went off, my watch. So I said, excuse me, I have to hurry off now to the Old Bailey to finish my cross-examination, but I'll be back. And I came back and said, several hours later, I'm sorry I had to interrupt myself, but I'm back now. And I spoke for another 45 minutes, getting some more stuff on the record from around the world about the medical harm that was being done by fluoridation in America, and the denial of any knowledge of this from so-called experts who said that we must introduce fluoride into the water here in order to preserve children's teeth, which it didn't quite do, but it was an item that did help. But, of course, brushing, teaching children to brush their teeth and to spit out any toothpaste that they've swallowed with fluoride in, would have the same effect. Of course, the trouble with fluoride was, although everybody agreed that it was one of the worst poisons you could find, the pro-authorities said, well, yes, but at one part per million, it's not really toxic. And they ignored the fact that this stuff stays in your system.
Well, I think you've got something in common with the current Secretary of State, RFK Jr. in the United States, on fluoride.
I love talking about fluoride, Martin, because it's one of those basic cases where this is a neurotoxin that they want to put in our water. And it's also a byproduct of some sort of nuclear process. And it's one of the most obvious things in the world. This is a disaster. It's toxic. It's nasty. But still, there are lobbies out there that manage to twist MPs' arms, or maybe they just bribe them or buy them a drink. And these MPs are a bit insecure and they want to be friendly with these people who say that fluoride should just be put into water, where you don't get any choice whether you use it or not. I mean, most toothpastes have fluoride in, and you have to actually go through the ingredients. All right, throw that one away. No, that one's got fluoride in, throw that one. And eventually you'll find one without, where you've got a choice. But when it comes to water being fluoridated, you don't have a choice, do you?
Well, no. Obviously, any network system like that where, you know, what's in the water, you've got to consume it. That's not going to be the case.
It's forced medication.
As I understand that there's certain parts of the country are fluoridated.
Do have it, yeah.
And other parts of the country do not. So, like a lot of things in this country, it's a bit of a mixed bag in terms of, you know, there isn't, in fact, a single policy.
Yeah, so would you worry about drinking fluoridate? Not here, apparently, in Bristol, but some parts of the country do.
Well, no doubt if you go to those parts of the country, you wouldn't know, would you? You just get a glass of water and you drink it. Although when I lived in outside the country, I used to live in Poland, I used to travel around in Eastern Europe, nobody drinks the water from the taps. Nobody does. I did it once in Latvia in the middle of the night. I got up in the hotel I was in, I was a bit thirsty, I drank some water from the tap, and it was a very bad idea. And, of course, the people in the hotel the next morning said, you didn't drink the water from the tap, did you? So that's what they lived with as normal.
Do you think King Charles, when he was in Italy, do you think he was drinking water from the tap in Italy?
I imagine he was given little bottles of San Pellegrino.
Maybe he took it with him because he doesn't trust anybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem is water supply. I mean, you know, in Eastern Europe back in the day, I don't know what the situation is now, you know, people just, you know, you could wash with the water, but you couldn't cook with it, so people had to go and buy great big, you know, bottles of water to for their cooking, because you couldn't cook with the water. You could do other things with it. You could shower with it or whatever, but you shouldn't drink it. Because it's got all sorts in it, not just fluoride, all sorts of stuff.
One of the people to look up if you're interested is Joy Warren. She does a brilliant anti-fluoride campaign. But you see, the thing is, there's this thing called the British Fluoridation Society, established in 1969. This is an industry body, Martin. A waste industry body, one would imagine. This is a whole bunch of people, media contacts, is somewhere who will chat to a journalist any time, night or day, and tell you all about how wonderful fluoride is. And so who on earth, in any normal world, would allow there to be a society which is instructing forced medication to poison people?
Well, as I understand it, the justification for fluoride is it protects people's teeth. Well, I don't know whether that's true, but, I mean, obviously, as you say, fluoride is in toothpaste, so to some extent there must be some kind of evidence for that. It's not my subject matter. Yeah, I mean, you know, at the same time, the dental national health system is collapsing. So, you know, we're putting fluoride in the water to protect people's teeth, but preventing them from seeing a dentist unless they've got thousands of pounds.
So it's called Fluoride Free Alliance UK. I think I will send that interview to Joy, because it was a joy to hear it. Her website is New FC, I suppose that's NEW Fluoride Campaign, newfc.org.uk, where you'll find the real McCoy. And looking at some other stories this week, we've got the I've got an interview now with a guy called Mark Hollingsworth. Now, Mark, he was on a few weeks ago talking about blacklisting, Martin, and the idea here, let's just recap that, is that there is a kind of profiling going on of everybody in the country, and one of those little, should we say, data fields on your profile is this person is part of a trade union, a union activist, is interested in things like the health and safety law, and therefore there's a black mark against your name. Now, I'm quite surprised that this is even legal, to say that here's somebody that might actually do something about breaches of health and safety and to save people's lives and join a trade union and be active. Is it actually legal to have these kind of blacklists?
Well, as I understand it, the Economic League, which is what we're talking about, was a private sector organisation set up by business people to try and ensure that they didn't employ union activists. Now, you could argue that provided they're just using their own resources to do this, then that is legal. Of course, there are laws against discrimination, which they may be breaking. But, of course, where it does become illegal is where they're using the state's files to profile people.
So is it fair for somebody who's a successful union activist of some sort to be prevented from working in their profession?
No, it's not, but it's been
the lot
of such union activists for many, many years.
Yeah.
Anybody who's a serious trade union activist knows very well that this is one of the risks you run.
This is the idea of government, surely, is to regulate this well and in some sort of just fashion, but they don't bother. I remember this is a few months ago, Martin, you talking about the IRA saying during the negotiations that this is John Major doing the negotiations for the ceasefire. Saying that our shareholders don't like this and won't find this acceptable.
That was Major saying that.
Yeah, that's John Major. But he was negotiating with the IRA, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. But I mean, what he was doing, which was silly, was he was... this was a secure line. I don't know who he was talking to.
Wasn't that secure?
Well, it wasn't secure because of the IRA helps. I'm recording the thing. Of course they will
be. To broadcast on RTE.
Well, yes, but I mean, they didn't. But obviously, they only broadcast it when there was a sticking point. Yeah. So, you know...
Well, you know, that was a fascinating period because the Major and the British would be incredibly disingenuous. They'd agree to certain things and then they'd find other excuses, rather like the Israelis and the Gaza ceasefire deal. Oh, we found a reason why we can't do this now and sorry about all that. And they're negotiating in bad faith. The Major was doing that, wasn't he?
Well, what he was doing there, which I found amusing rather than anything else, is this is a secure line. He could just say, I'll have to clear this with the cabinet, yeah? Or I'll have to speak to my colleagues. But he's treating it as if it was some kind of secret phone call, and I'll have to have a word with my shareholders about the takeover. I mean, who's he imagining listening in here?
Okay, so he was. In a way, it was having a word with his shareholders, wasn't it? Because there were a whole bunch of people who were invested in the city of London.
What was interesting to me about that was just why did he feel he needed to use this euphemism when you were actually negotiating directly a political agreement? You don't have to talk about it as if some kind of dodgy bank deal. You might as well just be upfront about it.
Maybe that's what he was used to.
Well, that's right. That's his background, of course.
Yeah. Dodgy bank deals,
and of course,
shareholders.
It's also because he's not used to using secret phone lines.
I mean,
like
is
that,
the government actually
that
just,
he's just got to make, you know,
Martin, is the government really of all stripes these days just administering the country for the benefit of city shareholders? That's what it sounds like.
Well,
some of these
listen,
things are
at
doing.
At the end of the day, there is a deep state here which is run by the very wealthy string pullers, and everything else, frankly, is a facade. And the sooner people realise that, the sooner the deep state are more interested
in controlling politics and controlling foreign policy and resources and the armed forces, aren't they? Surely, you know, the way that people are managed is like people on a farm, and the farm has shareholders and they want to get the best return from those people.
Look, I mean, what's happened in the US with the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court is any amount of money can be spent on elections anonymously. So this has just opened the floodgates that every election cycle in the US, the next one coming up is the congressional elections coming up in a couple of years, there'll be more money spent on those elections than ever before. And the last cycle was even more than that. And so in actual fact, most US politicians, like Obama was saying, as president, I spend 60% of my time talking to my funders. I only spend 40% of my time running the country. And I'm the president. And if you go further down the line, it's even worse. So in actual fact, you will find that lots and lots of politicians spend an awful lot of time talking to people who are going to fund them. Because you need money. And politics has become very much show business oriented. You need lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can't even play.
Well, nobody really talks about this. Like Darren, what's his name, Jones, the local MP chief secretary to the Treasury. Well, secret being the operative word. He's the secret keeper. Mark Hollingsworth, though, is not like that at all. And so this time I spoke to Mark this week about his other book. The first one I spoke to him was called Blacklist. And it's a fascinating look at these various organisations, the Economic League, Caprim, and the origins of this in the building trade after the First World War. The development builders who were trying to keep out any builders that would find safety issues and make a fuss about them. His book is called Londongrad, the more recent one, and it's all about the Russian oligarchs and Ukrainian oligarchs who came to London in the 1990s or in the 2000s after they'd been raping, destroying Soviet Russia. I started by asking Mark about the word oligarch, and he said it's a good idea to have a look at this word. What does it actually mean?
The word oligarch, it may be worth explaining what it means. It comes from the Greek. What it actually means is businessmen who make a lot of money, become wealthy through political manipulation and political influence and exploiting either corrupt politicians or where governments privatize state assets. So there's basically wealth through political influence and exploitation of a weak government, really. And that's where the word oligarch means. Just because you're rich doesn't necessarily make you an oligarch. So I think that's worth clarifying.
Well, look, the implication here is that you're getting political protection of some sort.
Yes. In Russia, they have this word that it means roof, and it's called, there is a Russian word, and the translation of it is roof.
It's krisha, I think, isn't it?
Krisha, you're quite right, is the word.
I mean, everyone needs their krisha. I think the same is true in journalism sometimes. You want someone protecting you.
And what it means is that you need to build a roof over your wealth in terms of you make your money. Often in the 1990s, it was through corruption and manipulation of the Russian state when Yeltsin was president, and how a small group of Russian oligarchs became very rich very quickly by manipulating President Yeltsin. And they sold off very valuable state assets for barely a 10% of their real value. But they also needed to protect that wealth. And so that's where they needed to have compliant politicians and to move the money out of Russia to protect it. And so there was a sort of protection racket going on. It wasn't just businessmen making lots of money. It was a whole network of political manipulation and making sure that your money and your wealth was safe. And so they didn't invest it back into Russia or give it to Russian charities or help Russian people. They moved the money abroad to secure it and keep it safe.
If you go back to the Yeltsin era, I mean, there was obviously a lots and lots of infrastructure in this managed economy. Almost all of the infrastructure in Russia was state-owned, or the industries were state-owned, and the oligarchs were in the process of selling it off. But, I mean, I would imagine that they needed some sort of training and finance to do that. Where did that come from?
Well, some of the oligarchs did have some expertise in understanding business, understanding the oil industry. I mean, quite a few of them didn't. The exception was probably Roman Abramovich, who was an oil trader in the early 90s. And he understood the oil business and the whole process of refining the oil and selling it and trading it. He had been an oil trader for a company in Switzerland. So he understood the value of oil. And so what happened in his case was that there was a very valuable oil field in Russia. He got together, Abramovich got together with another oligarch called Boris Berezovsky, who was very close to President Yeltsin. And Berezovsky was more of a political animal. He was a businessman. He had made a lot of money himself through privatization, particularly in the car industry and other businesses. But the two got together. And Abramovich identified the oil fields, which were incredibly valuable, and Berezovsky ensured that the auctions that took place were in their favor. And in simple terms, they were able to obtain assets, oil fields throughout Russia for only 100 million, and those assets were worth several billion, I mean, certainly 3 or 4 billion, and they got it for 100 million. And they borrowed that 100 million to buy, to benefit from those state assets, which were privatized to them. And I think even some of that 100 million that they paid, some of that money was borrowed even from the state assets, even from state banks. So it was, as they say, the sale of the century. And Abramovich and Berezovsky became very rich very quickly, and they set up this company called Sibneft. And, you know, that was the main deal that made Abramovich so wealthy. And they could only do it through influencing President Yeltsin, who went along with mainly American and Western economists who said they needed to privatize everything quickly. The Russian economy was in bad shape. They needed to sell off all these state assets. The problem is they sold them off on the cheap. And so that's how these oligarchs made so much money so quickly.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of what was going on in the 1990s. the there was a symbiosis between the Western advisors and the oligarchy within Russia itself and in the Ukraine. It's the Soviet Union.
Jeffrey Sachs was one of them, wasn't he actually, at the time, yeah?
Although what Jeffrey Sachs nowadays says is that he didn't advise them on the privatisation. He was talking about the stabilisation of the economy. But, of course, he was the one who allowed the, you know, let's just let prices rip, which, of course, then, you know, prices went through the roof and people were completely, you know, because if you've got a heavily monopolised economy, which the Russian economy was and many East European economies were, liberalising prices doesn't lead to a rational market price. Right. It just leads to the price going through the roof and people not being able to afford it.
And, of course, the thing is, as these prices go up and down, there are people making a fortune out of this.
That's right. I mean, what they probably needed to do...
I'm thinking about Trump as well, actually, yes, with the stock markets going up and down. Someone's making a killing.
Especially if you're an insider and you know when he's about to change his mind. And I'm sure there are plenty of people. I mean, you know, his sons and so
people
on.
People listening to his phones with a bug in the Oval Office and all that sort of thing.
What happened when Theresa May decided that she was going to fire missiles from the Akrotiri base into Syria is that she told her husband, a pillow talk in bed, and of course he went off the next morning and bought loads of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin shares. And he made a load of money out of it. And, you know, is it possible for the Prime Minister...
He was a funny guy. He had a weird laugh. If you ever track him down, if you want to have a very strange experience, which I wouldn't actually recommend at all, have a listen to the laugh of Theresa May's husband. It's something very, very creepy. It's like it's come from, like, the fiery pits of hell. I mean, it's a very strange chat. But anyway, Martin, look, back to the oligarchs. Do you have any, like, favourite oligarchs or interesting ones?
Well, I think the most interesting one from our point of view is Berezovsky. Because Berezovsky, as he says, was very close to Yeltsin. And Berezovsky was a political animal far more so than the other oligarchs. The other oligarchs wanted to make money, and for that they needed political connections. Berezovsky had political ambitions. So he didn't just want to be an oligarch.
He wanted to be like a kingmaker.
Well, he wanted to be a bit like...
And in fact, he was.
A Russian Rupert Murdoch.
He was a kingmaker.
Yeah, because he used to control NTV, which is one of the big TV stations.
It was the first private TV station. It was massive.
That's right. So in other words, he was a high-profile guy. So as a friend of Yeltsin's, he persuaded Yeltsin to bring Putin in to prevent the communist Zyuganov, who's the president of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. It looked as if he was going to win the elections in, I think it was in 2000. And that wouldn't have been out of line with what gone on in the rest of Eastern Europe. Because even
it's a backlash against this whole Westernisation.
That's right, so even in Poland...
I mean, they've been through a hell of a time in the 1990s with some people starving to death, for God's sake. Food supplies, because, I mean, you've got a planned economy and suddenly the market is let rip. Of course, this caused massive shortages.
Yes, and it wasn't just in Russia. I mean, previously, of course, the shock therapy that had pursued in other East European countries had been pretty dramatic. So in Poland, where I was living at the time, Balcerowicz plan, which again had been put together by Jeffrey Sachs, it wasn't as extreme as what happened in Russia, partly because the Polish government were let off half of their international debt for being such good little boys and overthrowing communism, which other countries didn't get. People in Hungary were upset about that. You know, why do they get let off half their debt and we have to pay everything? But anyway, Berezovsky was very close to Yeltsin. He persuaded Yeltsin to bring Putin forward as a means of trying to stop the Communist Party. Because the Communist Party...
Yeah, Putin was more credible, wasn't he, than Yeltsin. Yeltsin was a sort of babbling, a bit of a drunk.
In any case, Berezovsky thought that Zyuganov was going to win, because in Poland, the former Communist Party, Alexander Kwasniewski, he was a former communist, but he had won the presidential election in Poland. The reason being that having, you know, a good dose of capitalism had really made people think, gosh, capitalism, do
you
we really want this?
Solidarnosc in Poland.
Yes, that's right. So in other words, even in Solidarnosc Poland, where they've got very anti-communist attitudes and very anti-Russian attitudes, they voted for a former communist party. So in Russia itself, the Communist Party were well placed to win that election.
So basically, the Russian people had rumbled these oligarchs. They were looking at to bring a communist in.
Bring the communists back, basically.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they were familiar with them. You know, they kind of understood what, that, you know, can't we have a bit of that back? Yeah. But anyway, what happened was, of course, in 1999, September 1999, what I call 999, bomb attacks were carried out on working-class housing estates in Moscow and Ryazan.
These were actually kind of residential
blocks. Yeah. Supposedly carried out by the Chechens, which didn't make any sense because the Chechens had already got a completely independent state by that stage.
And you know what? NTV, Berezovsky's channel, was covering a lot of this. He was saying, well, look, someone's come around the back here and they found a load of explosives under this tower block.
But what NTV and the Berezovsky was doing, because Berezovsky had spoken to Samuel Basiev in Chechnya and he'd invaded Dagestan. So what they were doing was whipping up an anti-Chechen mentality, and then Putin rides in on a white horse and says, I will deal with this. Yeah, because people didn't know who he was, but he looked like sort of guy who could deal with stuff like
that. He knew a few things and he looked crazy.
And of course he did deal with it. And of course, at that stage, Berezovsky breathes a sigh of relief because Putin was his protege.
Okay, well, let's just leave it there for a second and let Mark Hollingsworth, the author of London Grad, take up the story of Berezovsky.
The Russian oligarchs were definitely interested in political influence in the UK, but they didn't understand the UK. The British political system. They thought that the House of Lords ran the country or the royal family ran the country.
Oh, yes, so they better be careful they don't tread on any toes, eh?
Exactly. And so he got close to Prince Michael of Kent, who's a member of the royal family, who actually looks like Tsar Nicholas II, and he speaks perfect Russian. Has a lot of Russian ancestry. But he didn't, and he paid a relatively amount of money in consultancy fees to Prince Michael of Kent, and never quite understood where real political power in the UK lay. He certainly tried. I think some members of the House of Lords were on the payroll or became directors or consultants of Russian companies. Berezovsky certainly had a relationship with the British state. It's not quite clear the depth of that. He certainly spoke at meetings with MI5 and was some kind of asset or informant as part of the deal to keep safe in London.
I'm going to guess that he possibly was chatting with MI6 as well, who might be interested in some of the contacts he had back in Russia.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. He was definitely some kind of informant, and that was part of the deal, that he would be protected in London if he acted as some kind of intelligence asset, or certainly as an informant. He was never formally recruited, because there was at least one, I'm sure there were several, assassination attempts orchestrated by the Kremlin against Berezovsky. He was public enemy number one, because he was so vocal in his criticism of Putin.
Yeah, so things started going wrong for Berezovsky, didn't they? And eventually he ended up being found dead in his house. So what happened there?
Well, he lasted about 12 years in London, and he was very active. But he spent huge amounts of money funding opposition groups. I mean, even at one stage, was building a ship which had cannons and guns attached to it, and he was very deluded. He thought that he could organize like a coup against Putin, but he was spending more and more money, and he would finance opposition groups in Ukraine, anyone who was opposed to Putin. I think in 2006, when Litvinenko was murdered, that gave him more of a platform, but he was gradually becoming less and less influential. And then he lost his lawsuit when he sued Abramovich. But he was definitely the public enemy number one.
So why did Abramovich and Berezovsky fall out? How did that happen?
Because when Berezovsky moved to the UK, he still had substantial assets and shareholdings in Russian companies, notably the NTV media company. And so Abramovich came to see him around about 2001, soon after he moved to the West, and was basically an emissary on behalf of Putin, and basically wanted him to sell all his assets at a knockdown price to Abramovich, was effectively to the Russian state. And he reluctantly agreed. And so, but later on, he just thought, he felt that he was manipulated and there was a sort of fraudulent misrepresentation. So he sued Abramovich in the High Court and he lost. He was a terrible witness, very arrogant, didn't prepare himself. And that case ended in about 2011. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for Berezovsky, really. And he was going through divorces. He was running out of money. And although that is some dispute. And so, however, he was still a thorn in the side of Putin. And then in 2013, he was found dead in one of his houses in Surrey, in the bathroom. And it appeared that he had hung himself in his bathroom in one of his houses in Surrey. And so it's never been proven either way. The jury's out in terms of whether he was murdered.
So what? It must have been an inquest. What did that have to say?
It didn't go either way. I think it was an inconclusive verdict. I'm not sure if the jury said there was foul play, but it didn't rule it out, if that makes sense. So I think it certainly was suspicious. There have been other murders of Russians in the UK, which, you know, just because a Russian dies in the UK doesn't mean to say he was murdered by the Kremlin. So you have to take each case on its own merits. But I think from what I've read and what I've been told, and I've spoken to people who were very close to Berezovsky, I know people who worked for him and was very close to him. And I would say majority think there was foul play and that he was murdered, but no one's ever been able to really provide clear evidence of it. It's just certainly very suspicious.
An open verdict is what they say. 67 yeah. years old. He was found on the bathroom floor of his Ascot home with a ligature around his neck. So some kind of suicide. But the coroner said he couldn't prove beyond all reasonable doubt that he took his own life or was unlawfully killed. So, yeah, an open verdict.
So Berezovsky was strangled to death, friends claim. As it is revealed, his security guard left him alone for 5 hours to run errands. He left no note. His friends say his suicide was not in his DNA. And police announced that he was hanged following a post-mortem. So this sounds like a fairly simple suiciding, doesn't it?
Except that the coroner refused to say it was suicide.
It was an open verdict. Let's just make that clear.
The police in Surrey, they said it was suicide, but the coroner wouldn't accept that because he was lobbied by Berezovsky's daughter, who thought that he'd definitely been murdered, but her suspicion was that he wasn't murdered by the Russians, he was murdered by the British. Because Berezovsky was thinking of talking, a bit like Skripal, was talking through back channels to Putin about the possibility of coming back to Russia.
Hang on, that's like Skripal, yeah.
Exactly the same. And of course,
so if someone has come to London, London grad, and then decides they want to try and actually, they think that Putin might be a better bet and wants to do a deal to come home, that might mean that they might have a sticky end like Berezovsky.
Yes, well, I think it's very interesting that...
Or Sergei Skripal, if he's still alive.
The British police and the British state were determined that this was not to be called a suicide. The coroner, who's not directly, you know, not directly under the control of the state, wouldn't go along with it because he'd been lobbied. And, of course, the daughter brought in people who were experts from Germany to argue it. And she was clear that she thought it was the British that had murdered Berezovsky.
Okay, so why is this still important? This is like nearly 15 years ago.
Well, it's still important because what it means is that the British state is Vinyenko was probably, this is getting really, really, you know, speculative now, but the speculation is that Litvinenko was actually murdered by Berezovsky, because the polonium that was used, the police traced it back to Berezovsky's office. Yeah? Now, in other words, what was going on there was Berezovsky was involved in very dodgy stuff. Litvinenko was one of his proteges, and it may be that Berezovsky got him murdered so that he could then claim that the Russians were terrible and the Chechens, he used to hang around with the Chechen opposition here as well. But I think for my money, it's more likely that he was murdered by the British than by the Russians. But of course, silly people in Britain just go, well, British don't go around murdering people. But I just say, phooey, it just depends. The British state wanted it to be serious. You'd have thought that if there was evidence that the Russians had done it, they would be very, very keen to go on about Berezovsky's been murdered by the Russians. Look at the way they behaved with Skripal. Look at the way they behaved with Litvinenko. They immediately jumped all over it, and the media here were all over it saying Putin, 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 Putin. In this case, not. The dog that didn't bark. And the state here wanting it to be suicide, even though the family didn't. And the coroner said that he didn't. If you think about it, it's quite hard to strangle yourself. Really difficult. Not easy at all. And of course, his security guards just happened to be out of the building for 5 hours without him knowing about it.
Well, certainly the father of poisoned agent Alexander Litvinenko discloses the name of the person he believed murdered Litvinenko. That is Walter Litvinenko, who's the father of Alexander Litvinenko, disclosed the name of the alleged killer of his son. He said this on the air of Channel 1 Russia's programme, Let Them Talk. As soon as Litvinenko Sr. appeared in the studio, he greeted former colleagues Andrei Lugovoy, who London considers one of Litvinenko's murderers. According to Litvinenko, his son was poisoned several times, even in a hospital. The murderer's name, according to Walter Litvinenko, was disclosed by the wife of Alexander Goldfarb, fellow oligarch of Boris Berezovsky. We go in Litvinenko room, and there's Goldfarb's wife, a young girl, sitting on the bed, crying and saying, Walter, Walter, Alex killed Alexander. Alex, it's Goldfarb. She told me openly that Goldfarb had killed Litvinenko. He visited the US 3 times while Sasha was in the hospital, apparently. So it could well be that that's, you know, certainly if his father, Litvinenko's father, doesn't believe that he was poisoned by Putin. In fact, he's prepared to sit down on a TV show and chit-chat with someone who the West is accusing of killing Litvinenko, his son.
And the same is true of Berezovsky's daughter. Yeah. Now, the point is that the West wanted these incidents, the Litvinenko incident and the Skripal incident was, to my mind, a completely scripted incident by MI6. There's a secret operation called Operation Beluga. We know the name of it because a French police officer, whose name escapes me now,
Barrel or something, is it? Yes, Barrel?
Yes, somebody
Paul
like
Barrel? No,
I can't remember.
Not sure.
We can look it up. He said, well, this has been going on for years, because, of course, what they've been trying to do for years is to blacken the name of the Russians so that they can have a war with them, because they don't like the regime and they want to overthrow the regime. So if you think about it, when Skripal was attacked, although eyewitnesses are saying somebody sprayed something on them in the restaurant, for example, so there's loads and loads of questions to be asked about this, the Russians were staging the World Cup. They've got all of the people all over the world coming to the new Russia to play football. It's a really important soft power moment for Putin and the Russian regime. So why would they go and try and murder somebody that they released years ago under some kind of exchange scheme?
So
the answer is that they wouldn't. There's no motive. In actual fact, they definitely avoid doing something like that. And of course, it was used in exactly that way.
Anyway,
so although British people went to Russia to be involved and they had a good time, everybody thought that the Russians aren't all that bad. But of course, they came home and said, Skripal, 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 Skripal. And of course, that undermined all of the soft power positives that the that World Cup might have
point the finger, fusspot of the week, nasty machine, saying someone is evil of the week. You know, it's very much like George Orwell. Now it's Trump. Everyone's pointing the finger at Trump. Oh, this terrible man. But the book is called Londongrad, From Russia with Cash, by I think it's fair to say, a good friend of this programme, Mark Hollingsworth, and Stuart Lansley. Although it's a bit out of date, it charts that whole period. It was quite important, wasn't it, Martin, in the idea. What it suggests to me is that Britain was very much involved in the rape of Russia in the 1990s, trying to take the city of London, trying to take the wealth of Russia and start to privatise and control it. And yet it all got nipped in the bud in 2000 by Putin.
Well, that's right. That's why Putin, Putin first came to power, I thought he was a creature of the oligarchy. I thought
so did they.
So that's right, but he wasn't. And it turns out once he got into a position, Putin is from what they call the Siloviki, the securocrats. So if you were an oligarch,
that's MI5. Russia's MI5, isn't it? The FSB. Or is it a foreign one? MI6?
He was KGB, so he was a bit different. But the point is, he was from that side of things, yeah? He was a military person, yeah? And of course, you know, George Bush Sr. used to head the CIA, so it's not that unusual for these things to happen. But the point is that
Tampon Charlie's in charge of all of these things.
They've got to have somebody, you know, the Siloviki basically got fed up with the oligarchy because they were undermining the integrity of the state. You know, what Khodorkovsky was going to sell off the Siberian oil industry to Israeli interests, because Khodorkovsky, like many of these oligarchs, was Jewish. Berezovsky was Jewish, and so was many of these other oligarchs. I'm not putting anything onto that, but a lot of them were. A lot of Russians were saying that at the time. These guys all seem to be Jewish, don't they?
Well, never mind seem to. Surely, like, the top 10 all were Jewish, weren't they?
Yeah, right.
That sounds like an anti-Semitic comment by you.
No, it's just a statement of fact. It's not because they were Jewish that they were stealing everything. It's because they were stealing everything. Others who were not Jewish were also stealing
things. You remind me very much of the Paul Manning book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where the laundered cash from the whole of Europe during the Nazi era, the billion or so dollars that they'd managed to scrape together in Swiss banks, mainly in Argentina, was all laundered into these 750 companies, the Fourth Reich businesses, and they were fronted, almost all of them were fronted by Jews. The idea here is that if there's a Jewish person in charge of this business, no one will suspect that it's actually been laundered Nazi money that's got the business going.
That's right. And of course, money has its own power. Money talks to anybody.
So are there any other oligarchs you think are important, interesting people? Because we're going to go and have a look at... Actually, maybe we'll just listen to this first. This is looking at... Mark talks about some of the Ukrainian oligarchs now.
People forget that before the Ukraine war, you know, there was just as many Ukrainian oligarchs, and often some of them just as controversial and just as wealthy, and had obtained their wealth through privatization of very valuable natural resources in Ukraine. And they did the same thing. So, for example, there was a Ukrainian oligarch called Akhmatov, and he made a lot of money, and he did the usual thing, and he moved it to the UK, and he spent $100 million in London just on two flats at a place called One Hyde Park. So they were luxury apartments, penthouse on One Hyde Park in Knightsbridge. So that gives you, you know, an example of the amount of wealth that the Ukrainian oligarchs had. And you had other people, who were Ukrainians, Blavatnik, and other Ukrainians, Kolomoisky, who became very close to President Zelensky. And so the Ukrainian business, men were no angels, and there was just as much manipulation, and influence peddling in Ukraine, as there was in Russia. And so, Ukraine is far from a corruption-free zone.
Well, that's right. Ukraine is far from a corruption-free zone. But what happened in Russia, of course, is when Putin came to power, he started to, you know, he basically started to clean up Dodge because they've got a, they, you know, they had a, you know, the long term survival of the Russian state and Russian culture was at stake. Whereas in the Ukraine, there was never a clean out of the oligarchy. They remained in full charge of everything. I mean, basically, the oligarchs ran the show. Zelensky was a protege of Kolomoisky, again, another Jewish guy, but again, a very controversial figure. And Kolomoisky used to control the TV station on which Zelensky played this teacher who becomes president and servant of the people. And this is all actually, you know, manipulation. So Kolomoisky has chosen him to be on the show. He's on the show for several, you know, it was a very successful show. Apparently people liked it. And then, of course, he can then at the end of it say, in actual fact, Zelensky is going to be the president with a party called Servant of the People, which is the same as the name of the show. And that's how Zelensky came to power. Kolomoisky then was actually saying, when I used to be on RT, which I haven't been on for some years now, Kolomoisky was saying, you know, not very loudly, but he was definitely on the record of saying, we're probably going to have to do a deal with the Russians. You know, we're going to have to be reasonable here. Some deal will have to be done. But he was then removed. And Zelensky's managers now, the creature for Zelensky as we speak, isn't an oligarch in the Ukraine. It's actually our own dear MI6. He is a puppet of Western intelligence services. And Kolomoisky is living in exile in Israel because, of course, many of these oligarchs had dual citizenship, Israeli and Russian, because of their heritage. And, of course, if things get too hot in Russia or Ukraine, you can disappear to Israel, which at one stage the estimates were that the Russian-Ukrainian mafia controlled 40% of the Israeli economy. Because loads and loads of people emigrated there because they were allowed to, you know, and so that's where they went.
So the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project has a fascinating article all about Viktor Pinchuk and some of these other, well, they call his businessmen. They don't use the word, they use words billionaires, and they don't use the word oligarch. One Ukrainian businessman demanded $2 billion from two others in the London High Court in a dispute over one of their home country's largest iron ore processing operations. The three reached a secret settlement several days before the trial. Reporters found the details of that settlement, two high-value buildings in the heart of London, in the Paradise Papers documents. These are Viktor Pinchuk, who for me is the most interesting of all of the Ukrainian oligarchs, being the one who was organising the coup, etc. And also the master of one of the lowest numbered Masonic lodges in Kiev, as well as Igor Kolomoisky, you mentioned there, who was the guy who basically owned Zelensky and his whole career, and someone called Gennady Bogolyubov. They're Ukraine. Anyway, I'll put a link up to this because it's fascinating. I think it's great to see that people at the, you know, the Organised Crime Reporting Centre and Corruption Reporting Project are doing detailed investigations into some of these deals. So anyway, the book, like I say, is called London Grad from Russia with Cash, and it's by the excellent Mark Hollingsworth.
Can I just say that let's try and get our use of language correct here. Russia and Ukraine have oligarchs. In the West, we have philanthropists.
Yeah? Like the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds.
Philanthropists. They're not oligarchs, they're philanthropists.
So we know what's the difference? What is the difference?
There isn't one. I'm just saying that that when we use the word oligarch, it's got a pejorative term. And of course, nothing these people have been doing is any different from what goes on in the good old US of A. But in the good old US of A, these people are philanthropists and business people. Yeah. But of course, they're not. They're oligarchs in exactly the same way as they are in Russia and Ukraine.
Here begins the first verse of the 14th chapter of St. John's Gospel, where Jesus comforts his disciples, urging them to trust in God and in him. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, but I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and we will be satisfied. Jesus said to him, Have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you still do not know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, Show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. But if you do not, then believe me because of the works themselves. Very truly I tell you, the one who believes in me will also do the works that I do, and in fact will do greater works than these, because I am going to the Father. I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If in my name you ask me for anything, I will do it. Here ends the second lesson.
Thank you. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. He descended into hell. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting.
Days when you feel as though you got out of bed on the wrong planet. This is one of those, I think. Prudens Futuri, and that's called In the Name of the One.
Mm-hmm.
flashing by us we lost our starry notions on the way. If by chance I'd see you in the tavern, we'd smile at one another and we'd say, those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. We'd live the life we choose. We'd fight and never lose. Those were the days. Oh yes, those were the days. Da 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 da. Just tonight I stood before the tavern.
So that's a little bit of choral evensong from Wednesday. The actual location was St Matthew's Church, Westminster, just around the corner from the Quaker Meeting House, where the police decided they are going to arrest a whole bunch of non-violent activists who are trying to bring attention to the genocide, amongst other things. And the good old Metropolitan Police wading on the wrong side. So no wonder they need some sort of Sherlock Holmes to explain to them. No, go and arrest Victor Pinchuk, drag him in, and stop letting all these massively powerful oligarchs and other criminals and people in the royal family, for example, go free, and go and nick a few of them instead of these people who are actually trying to sort the world out. Otherwise, what's the point of paying for these coppers, unless we're living in a fascist country, of course. And then we had in a contrast, I think it's important actually to have a bit of spiritual balance sometimes in our broadcasts here, and that, of course, was not anything really churchy. It was a group called Prudens Futuri from 1995 on the John Peel programme. I played that before, I know, but it's absolutely brilliant. It'd be nice to see it in a film all about Tampon Charlie and various other characters who are trying to get Armageddon going, amongst them the others, obviously Netanyahu over in the Holy Land, causing hell there, causing chaos that they hope to control. And finally, we had Mary Hopkins from 1968. Those were the days. Anyway, welcome back to Not the PCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, speaking to you live. We really are live right now. That is in a corner of freedom, close by Bristol city centre. Martin, we're going to start by looking at Gaza again, because the United Nations has been saying this week that, well, heads of six United Nations agencies are saying are issuing a grave warning about the situation in Gaza. Most definitely, they believe it's a genocide, and what's happening now is the people who live there are being starved to death, and their water is being withheld. So, and also the medical facilities are in total collapse. So if the six UN agencies can't get on the news by issuing a grave warning, I mean, what on earth is going on? And can you just give us your take on the recent events in Gaza?
Well, it is, as you've just suggested, obviously the population, those of them that are still alive, are very, very weak. They're prey to all kinds of potential diseases. They've got no food or water. I mean, how long can people live in a place like Gaza in the summer without water? And the answer is not very long. So the time for something to happen to rescue these people is now. But as you know, that's not what's happening.
So what would you suggest if you were in any sort of position to do something about this?
Well, obviously, the thing that ought to happen is a ceasefire ought to be the ceasefire that was agreed should be reinstated, and therefore that means that the Israelis have got to withdraw from Gaza and they've got to allow humanitarian aid in, and then of course rebuilding. But the Israelis have withdrawn from the ceasefire that they agreed. And now they're saying, they don't really want a ceasefire. They've never wanted one. And therefore, they're not going to have one. So that's where we're at.
So our correspondent Fatima is actually in northern Gaza. So I thought we'd start with an exclusive little listen to what she has to say this week. Bless her, Fatima. I do hope the listeners will put in a word to him upstairs for her, to protect her, because obviously we're in this situation now, Martin, where journalists, anybody that's getting information out of their evidence of war crimes, is being specifically targeted. We heard last week about this report that's saying that more journalists have been killed in the last 18 months in Gaza than over the last 120 years, including two world wars, in all conflicts.
Well, that's because they've been deliberately targeted. And I presume Fatima is not possibly the real name of the person that's going to be speaking to us.
Well, perish the thought. But yeah, I mean,
I would be surprised if it was. It'd be foolish to be.
We are taking whatever measures we can, which is not a lot, to make sure that that Fatima is not specifically identified. Anyway, I mean, there are all sorts of systems that these AI systems use now that they can try and find out who said that. Who said that? Let's kill them. I mean, this is basically what AI is, and yet we're being told, "Oh, this is wonderful. This is going to take over. Isn't it going to be great?" No, it's not going to be great. You know, creating these kind of sex robots and this sort. This is where these perverse people are taking us. And I think time to rewatch that brilliant BBC children's TV series from the 1970s, which I can remember rushing home from school to watch. Sad Little Tony. I think it was on a Tuesday evening for a couple of months. That was absolutely riveting, and you can get it on DVD. If you've never seen it and your kids have never seen it, watch The Changes. It's all about how people turn against technology and start smashing up technology. And I think there's definitely a place for that in some of this AI, and especially the use of it in this utterly diabolical, evil way in targeting individuals by the Israelis. And, using the British Royal Air Force, the Luftwaffe Nazi force, to give them targeting information and things like that. So genocide is no laughing matter. You can't mess around. It needs to be nipped in the bud, or it will go further, as we'll be hearing later. But let's give pride of place today to Fatima in northern Gaza.
Hi, this is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of freedom in northern Gaza under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. Israeli occupation is destroying the whole Gaza Strip. It is destroying water desalination plants. It is destroying hospitals in Gaza. It is destroying makeshift shelters. It is destroying every kind of life in Gaza, and all of it backed by U.S. tax dollars. Israeli occupation targets key infrastructure to make life much harder and uninhabitable for Palestinians in Gaza, while enforcing a blockade to make sure no goods enter. It is genocide through starvation and disease. It is not just bombs massacring Palestinians. Gaza's healthcare system has collapsed under continuous Israeli bombardment, with the situation spiraling beyond control. The hospitals are critically short on medicines, wound dressings, vital supplies, and specialized care. The killing of medical workers and the inability to replace them have intensified the crisis. So the international community must intervene, as dozens of Palestinian injured patients are lying untreated on hospital floors at risk of dying amid ongoing attacks and medical system failure. Since October 7th, Israel occupation has killed over 27 Red Crescent staff in Gaza. Humanitarian groups continue to face deadly threats as Israel occupation intensifies its attacks, ignoring global calls for a ceasefire. For the Palestinian journalists, they were not spared from the Israel occupation airstrikes and Israel occupation oppression. Well, they were deliberately targeted during this genocide, as on one of the incidents against Palestinian journalists is on April 7, 2025, where an Israel occupation airstrike targeted a tent within the Nasser Hospital compound in Khan Yunis, Gaza, killing at least 10 Palestinians, including journalists Hilmi Al-Faqawi and Ahmad Mansour, and injuring several others. For Ahmad Mansour, the moment he was burned alive was live-streamed. He suffered severe burns all over his body and died the following day from his injuries. While Mansour was engulfed in flames, the world stood by and did nothing. It was a blood-curdling footage. The journalist and photographer Hassan Islahi has sustained injuries to his head and right hand in the same attack. The tent was being used by journalists and civilians at the time of the strike. This incident adds to the growing number of Palestinian journalists affected by the Israeli genocide, with reports indicating that over 210 journalists have been killed since October 2023. The tent that was targeted by Israel occupation airstrikes was being utilized by journalists and civilians at the time of the attack, while, as usual, Israel occupation issued a false claim accusing one of the injured journalists called Hassan Slayeh of being a resistance member to justify its horrific crime. However, Slayeh was widely known for his work documenting the Israeli genocide against Palestinians on social media. Thank you.
So, from a corner of freedom in Bristol and a corner of freedom in northern Gaza, Martin, this situation, it seems to me that there's two kind of major angles to this. One is that the Israelis, along with their friends in the Labour Party and the Tory Party, and within the City of London, etc., have decided they're going to get away with this because they can control the press, and they will control the press coverage of what goes on, and they will control the evidence of their war crimes from getting to the British public and to other publics around the world but via the press.
They certainly are, but just before I go on, I'll remind people that tomorrow in Bristol at 1:30, assembling at Castle Park by the bandstand, there will be a protest about all of these things for people who are local. And, of course, we're not going to be silenced in Bristol or anywhere in many other parts of the world.
Do you think it's possible to use the press in this way for such an absolute blanket propaganda in order to allow a Third World War or something similar to actually get going over there? Say, for example, a nuclear war between Israel and Iran.
Well, I mean, let's face it, propaganda has been an integral part of war fighting forever. So it's not that surprising that they're using their control of media to try and control narrative. I mean, you know, the Israeli Hasbara machine is absolutely, you know, loads of people paid loads of money to spin things in their direction. I mean, what they're hoping to do now is that everybody's just bored of Gaza. It's so last. It's so 2023, you know.
It's not news anymore.
Can't you just move on?
It's not news anymore. The same amount of Gazans are being killed every day. I think at the moment we're just looking at about 40 innocent people killed within 24 hours a day, so that's not really news anymore, is it?
Well, I think the people do get inured to these things, and also they just feel powerless. Well, what can I do? And of course, many people in Britain are probably unaware of our direct role in what's going on because of the base at Akrotiri. I mean, how many people in Britain know that we've got a base at Akrotiri? I'll bet you it's far less than half the population.
Well, the broadcaster should be banging away at that, and that base should be closed down, of course, because it's actually part of war criminal activities. I suppose we don't really care too much about war crimes, Martin, having started an illegal war in Iraq.
No, and I think you know, the warmongering neoconservatives that dominate in this country and the United States, I mean, they are co-responsible for this terrible...
I mean, it was working in a way. Massacre. Iraq was working up for this, wasn't it? It was kind of getting people prepared for something even more horrific.
Well, that's right, because the whole point is that is the domination of the global system. Domination of the global system means dominating the oil trade, and dominating the oil trade then gives the US and its British allies control over third countries, e.g. China, who don't have any oil of their own. So you can see what it's all about. And the Israeli state has played a role in dominating the Middle East on behalf of outside powers. And of course, you know, the military government in Egypt is 100% backed by Britain and the US, even though it's probably more repressive than the Assad regime.
But if you criticise...
They're on our side, so we don't care.
Yeah, and the other major aspect to this whole business, other than the propaganda and the control of the press, is if you criticise the Israeli state, then you must be anti-Semitic. You must be a Nazi.
Well, that's right. I mean, then that's a way of silencing opposition and so on. We all know what the game is if you're on the receiving end, certainly. You know, there's nobody to stop them if they want to carry on what they're doing, because the problem they're going to find, of course, is they can kill everybody, virtually everybody there, but the fighters will still be in the tunnels and they'll still have the weaponry.
Well, let's have a listen to this UN report about the UN saying that these agencies saying that there's issuing this grave warning this week. I was interviewed in live translation into Arabic on the Beirut channel, Hezbollah's channel, I think it is, Al Mayadeen TV, about control of the press in the West. So if you speak Arabic or you know anyone that is, you can send them that interview. I have absolutely no idea what they said. I said, I think they're pretty good, actually. But anyway, let's have a listen now to, I think this is Press TV report this week, looking into what the UN is saying about what's going on in Gaza. And of course, this should be blasted out from the rooftops. It should be an alarm call to all of our representatives, politicians, government, and banks, and anyone with a human soul, to stop it immediately.
There are still so-called analysts not calling what is happening in Gaza a genocide. What's your response to that?
Know the meaning of the word genocide. There's no doubt that what is happening here is the killing of a nation based on its identity as a nation. That is the definition of genocide. There is no other way to interpret it.
Right. Given Donald Trump's previously stated plan to remove Palestinians from Gaza and relocate them elsewhere, do you see the Israeli regime is moving toward that goal by Donald Trump?
Well, it seems that the Israeli regime is taking whatever it can get from the United States and doing as much damage and as much murder, because this is nothing other than mass murder, as it can get away with. And whatever Donald Trump might have had in his mind when he talked about making a resort in Gaza, that idea is a no-go proposition at this case, because there is no one in this world that I know of who would like to vacation on a territory covered in the bodies of murdered children.
Donald Trump today welcomed Netanyahu again. You have always believed that Donald Trump will somehow in the future turn against Netanyahu and his policies because they are somehow against the United States of America. Did you sense that, let's say, turning of a position by Donald Trump?
No, not at all. And I have to say that as a person who strongly supported Trump in the American elections and who strongly supported Trump when he was robbed of the election previously, I have to say that what he is playing is a no-win game now. Donald Trump presented himself as the America First president. And what he is doing now is he is putting Israel first. He is putting Israel first in Gaza. He is putting Israel first in America. And he is putting Israel first around the world, because if the Europeans could grow a backbone and tell him what they think about what he's doing now, he would take the blame and he would take the punishment, and Israel would not. So Donald Trump needs to reassess his situation. And I once again maintain that if Donald Trump is not a fool, he will turn against what is obviously an out-and-out intentional genocide by the State of Israel and by Benjamin Netanyahu.
All right, now let's get back to the topic of Gaza. Do you believe the call for a renewed ceasefire, as I was reading it a few seconds ago, has any realistic prospect?
It just depends on whether somebody puts some pressure on Netanyahu. Netanyahu was facing a removal from office by his own citizens. His own Israeli citizens were moving to convict him for corruption and were going to defeat him had there been an election. And it was a breath of fresh air to Netanyahu that he had this opportunity to unite the Israeli population against the Palestinians by saying that every Palestinian, be it an aged person, a woman, or a child, must bear the retribution of Israel for the actions of Hamas. And I know that it says in the Jewish part of the Bible that there shall be an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But the idea that Israel should take 50,000 people's lives in return for barely 1,000 of its victims goes beyond even the biggest retribution ever described in the Jewish Old Testament of the Bible.
John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Fredericton, Canada. Thank you for your insight.
Well, it sounds like John Bosnich has changed his tune. He doesn't think that Trump is going to be controlling Netanyahu. He seems to think it's the other way around.
Well, I think that Trump's funding for his election campaign came from Adelson, and you know, she's very, very pro Netanyahu, and you know, those are the people who elected Trump. Netanyahu elected Trump. Really, the American people are secondary. Elections are won with money, as we were saying in the first part of the
show. Netanyahu on Tuesday was in the White House, wasn't he? The Oval Office, having a nice little chit chat with Donald. I suppose they're planning their next atrocities together. So let's have a listening to that now.
Reverend from the Times of Israel, the IDF is fighting to get in the Gaza Strip. I myself might be called up in a month. Do you think that's the way to pressure Hamas to get to a deal? And do you think blocking humanitarian aid is also an effective pressure tactic?
Well, you know how I feel about the Gaza Strip. I think it's an incredible piece of important real estate. And I think it's something that we would be involved in. But, you know, having a peace force like the United States there, controlling and owning the Gaza Strip would be a good thing. Because right now, all it is for years and years, all I hear about is killing and Hamas and problems. And if you take the people, the Palestinians, and move them around to different countries, and you have plenty of countries that will do that, and you really have a freedom a freedom zone. You call it the freedom zone, a free zone, a zone where people aren't going to be killed every day. That's a hell of a place. It's a, you know what I call it? A great location that nobody wants to live in, because they really don't. And when they had good when they have good living, real living, where Hamas and all of the problems they have, the level of death on the Gaza Strip is just incredible. And I've said it. I don't understand why Israel ever gave it up. Israel owned it. It wasn't this man, so I can say it. He wouldn't have given it up. I know him very well. There's no way. They took oceanfront property and they gave it to people for peace. How did that work out? Not good.
Is the immigration, sorry, Mr. President, is the immigration plan still on the agenda?
Which immigration?
From Gaza. From Gaza.
All it is a concept that I had that I think is good, and now people are copying it. You know, maybe you want to tell, people are talking about the Trump plan. Gee, why don't we do that? Would you like to answer that question?
I think what the president talked about is, first of all, to give people a choice. You know, Gazans were closed in. Any other place, including in arenas of battle, I mean, whether it's Ukraine or Syria or any other place, people could leave. Gaza was the only place where they locked them in. We didn't lock them in. They're locked in. And what is wrong with giving people a choice? Now, we've been talking, including over lunch, about some countries, I won't go into them right now, that are saying, you know, if Gazans want to leave, we want to take them in. And I think this is the right thing to do. If you give, you know, it's going to take years to rebuild Gaza. In the meantime, people can have an option. The president has a vision. Countries are responding to that vision. We're working on it. I hope we'll have good news for you.
So there's Netanyahu there saying we should give people a choice. They can leave or they can die.
Well, that's right. The obvious thing, don't forget that the people in Gaza, they used to live in the adjacent areas of Israel. So from Gaza, if you were in the tower block, you could look over the fence and you could see where the Israelis are living. That used to be our house over there. We used to live just there, and they can see it. And the obvious place for the Gazans to go, if you wanted to move them somewhere, is to Israel itself. You could take them back to the villages they came from and house them there. You'd have to put them in tents to start with, and then you've got to build nice houses for them and give them citizenship. Yeah, so they can vote in elections. But they're not going to vote for you, Netanyahu, are they? Maybe you need to go back to Poland. Or is it Ukraine where you came from?
Anyway, Jeffrey Sachs had a few things to say about Netanyahu turning up in Washington.
A man with an international arrest warrant for war crimes and crimes against humanity. I'm speaking of Netanyahu. He is a mass murderer. He is a killer. He commits war crimes. And he has control over American foreign policy and over American domestic policy now. That's the fact. The U.S. government is run by Israel, by the Israeli government. Why and how? It's a little hard to say, but it is the unbelievable fact that this brazenness, this recklessness, this cruelty, this arrogance from this extremist Israeli government controls American policy vis-a-vis speech in the United States now. It's shocking but true. We see it now every day with arrests and deportations. Like Friedman said, he gloated. We shudder. Unbelievable.
Professor Sachs, aren't tariffs taxes on consumers? And aren't they going to cause massive inflation here in the United States?
Yeah, tariffs are going to lower living standards. They're going to wreck the U.S. economy, and they're being put on for unbelievably bizarre and mistaken reasons that are completely fallacious.
So, yeah, so there's Jeffrey Sachs answering two different questions. One about the do you think he's right when he says that Israel controls the United States? Because a lot of people think it's actually the US deep state and people like Trump that actually control Israel. They're funding it because they want it to do a little mission for them.
Well, don't forget, Jeffrey Sachs is himself an American citizen. So if he wants
and he's
to,
Jewish.
Yeah, he is Jewish as well, but he's an American citizen. And, of course, when Americans talk about this isn't in America's interests, what they're trying to get their fellow citizens to understand is this isn't in our interest. So that's why they talk about Israel controlling the US state. I think, in actual fact, they are that the Israeli state and the US deep state and the British deep state are all integrated. They all know each other. They discuss their plans. There are some difference in emphasis between the three big pillars of Western imperialism, and there's some tensions between the three big pillars, but at the end of the day, they're all the same team, and they're all part of trying to control the world on their behalf.
So Scott Ritter takes a different approach to Jeffrey Sachs, the opposite, really. He says that Trump is just completely in control of Netanyahu, and whilst Netanyahu is battling away and killing people over there, he's completely expendable. At some point, there'll be a button press and a great big hole will open underneath Netanyahu. Down he'll go, and someone else will be found to replace him.
Well, that may happen, and it may happen to Trump, and it may happen to Scott Ritter. I mean, anybody can be, you know, trapdoors can open up under anybody. Nobody's indispensable.
Yeah, so Scott Ritter's been talking about Zionism everywhere this week, as well as David Miller has been. And David has been accused of being anti-Semitic by the Palestine Solidarity campaign. David is himself very much a pro-Palestine campaigner, anti-Zionist campaigner, and he's been battling away through the courts here. But the Palestine Solidarity campaign said he's gone too far by going on to right-wing podcasts and things like that and talking. And so they are trying to get all the Palestine Solidarity groups right across Britain, including here in Bristol, where David lives, to deplatform him. So what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's very regrettable that those who ought to be on the same side here, in the face of what we've previously been discussing, you know, the imminent execution of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Palestinians, that we shouldn't really be having these squabbles. But I know that human beings being what they are, it's often difficult to get everybody lined up for all kinds of reasons.
So you're not saying anything there about the possibility that actually it's the Israelis infiltrating these groups that are starting these squabbles?
Well, I mean, the whole thing about anti-Semitism is their game. And if people go on about somebody being anti-Semitic because they've been on a right-wing podcast, well, you know, I mean, what David would say, I presume, if he was here, is I go on all sorts of podcasts. That doesn't mean I agree with the people doing the podcast. That's
well,
just silly.
He might even come on ours.
Well, indeed, the point is you can go on somebody's, you know, you can go on a podcast of somebody who you disagree with completely. You don't have to, you know, just because you're on their podcast doesn't mean you agree with them.
Anyway, so let's have a listen to David Miller's take on this. And this is why he says it's so important. And I think he's absolutely right that what's going on over in Gaza is also going on here in the UK with the purging of people like him, academics.
When I'm talking about the Zionist movement, and when I talk about what I call Zionist family foundations, which are the foundations which are set up by rich Zionists to send money to the Zionist movement, to whether that's in the UK, Zionist groups in the UK or Zionist groups in occupied Palestine. And that is what the Zionist movement is engaged in on a daily basis, including, of course, support of the schools and the youth groups, which radicalise and groom young people.
Yeah.
But what you're touching on is something, I think, which is different, but which is additional to to that kind of Zionist movement activity. And that is in particular the penetration by the Israeli state and in particular its intelligence apparatus of the high tech industry, including areas of health and education, surveillance, and all sorts of other cloud computing, etc. All sorts of other things. Now, there's clearly been a strategy of the Israeli intelligence agencies, including especially Unit 8200, which is, as you know, it's a signals intelligence unit of the Israeli Defense Forces. And that means that they have been trying to penetrate and gain contracts with all sorts of different countries. You mentioned the 2030 roadmap, truly chilling document, which encourages Israeli firms to penetrate the health service. And this is one example. I mean, I think probably the best example. There's a firm called Oracle, which is led by convinced Zionist, which has the multi-billion contract per year, multi-billion per year contract to provide cloud computing services for the National Health Service, the Ministry of Defence, the Foreign Office, and the Home Office, which are, all of which, the last three of the four, are of national security importance for Britain. Of course, that's where the intelligence agencies of Britain are based. And nobody seems to think it's a problem that a company which has direct connections with Israeli intelligence has access to all this cloud computing infrastructure. And it's truly extraordinary. That's one example. There are many, many other examples. So that's another whole section of concern of Zionist penetration of the UK, for example. So there's another area which you used the word infiltration. Mm. Look, I think this is an even more thoroughgoing question, which is the question of infiltration. When the Zionists had their first World Zionist Congress post the creation of the colony in 1948, it was in Jerusalem. I think it was 1951, might be 52. Anyhow, they created a new program for the Zionist movement, because the program for the Zionist movement had previously been creating the State of Israel. But now they created the State of Israel, they said, okay, so shall we abolish the Zionist movement, or shall we continue it? And they voted overwhelmingly, I think with very, very few votes against, they voted to continue the Zionist movement. And the Zionist movement then came up with a new program called the Jerusalem Program, because that's where they were meeting in Jerusalem. And amongst the five or six key points of the Jerusalem Program, which you can see in our website, Powerbase, or any other place you look it up, one of the key points of the aims of the Zionist movement is to popularize Zionism in the community, by which they mean the Jewish community in particular. But you can see that obviously popularizing Zionism and the Zionist movement in Jewish communities all around the world is going to have the effect potentially of popularizing it in the societies in which they are embedded. And so that's a recipe I suggest for infiltration. Now, of course, if it was the case that Jews were, as they like to imagine, are discriminated against and the victims of the oldest hatred, then that would be another matter. But actually, you know, Jews are in Western societies, including in the UK, in relatively economically advantaged positions. All the economic data shows that they're more economically advantaged than any ethnic minority, and indeed more economically advantaged than white people.
So that's Dr. David Miller there. I'll put an interview to the full interview, a link to that, up on our show page. Well, that really is anti-Semitic, isn't it, Martin, saying that Jews are actually economically advantaged?
Well, it's true. It's statistically true. But that doesn't mean that all Jews are wealthy. Many Jews are not, but some are. And if you, I mean, you know, you can, we break down, you know, economic statistics by ethnic origin, then they are relatively, the Jewish community is in this country relatively wealthy compared to others. But that doesn't mean that every Jewish person is wealthy. It just doesn't. There's plenty of poor Jews and there's plenty of rich Muslims. We shouldn't really, I mean, it's useful to know, but it doesn't get you very far.
Well, the idea is that there's this whole idea of victimhood, and what he's saying there, that it's actually Jewish people are advantaged, they're not victims. It's not all that helpful, but there are all sorts of statistics out there saying this. But saying, well, what about this idea of now David Miller being banned from platforms?
Well, I wouldn't ban him from any platform that I wanted to. You know, I'd very much want to hear what he's got to say. Plus, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, if they want to argue that he's got to be banned from the platforms, have got to make the case. Yeah? And, of course, there is residual Zionist genuflection in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. Like because we don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism, we bend over backwards to give in to people saying, well, that was an anti-Semitic remark, blah, blah, blah. And I think, given the situation that we're now in, it seems perverse, frankly. I mean, and also, just another point I'd make is, you don't have to agree with about everything with everybody. It really isn't necessary for everybody to agree about everything. It's quite possible to have completely different views. On this show, we've had pro-Zionist Christian Zionists on our show, have we not?
We have a pretty good spread, I think.
That doesn't mean that we agree with them. It just means we talk to them, because if we don't talk to them, the only solution is you've got to fight them.
We have Benjamin Netanyahu just now. Anyway, in fact, we were accused, weren't we, by UK laws for Israel of being anti-Semitic. And then I pointed out in the reply to Ofcom, who, by the way, are Bilderbergers and have been involved in all sorts of dodgy stuff, like putting together this online safety bill. I might also mention that the channel BitChute is now not available in the UK. It's available everywhere else, just like RT is available in most of the world, but not here in the UK. Just like Press TV, the English language Iranian programme, is available almost all over the world, but not in the UK. So now BitChute, the channel, has gone dark in the UK this week. You can still, and I'm uploading stuff for the rest of the world to watch, but Britain is becoming an incredibly censorious country. And I want to just pick up on one thing that David Miller was saying there about the infiltration of the National Health Service, the cloud computing, trying to get, you know, basically all of our data. And also massive amounts of money for these NHS contracts, because I had a chat earlier this week with a lady called Alison Wright. She used to work for IBM in Africa, and she's going to take us in a long clip we're going to hear now through some of the horrors that she discovered when she was working in the 1990s in Africa for IBM. Her boss, it seems, was part of something very much looking like a kind of Fourth Reich. The idea is this is neocolonialism, and we are going to control these African countries via our computer networks.
So my name's Alison Wright. So I was Alison Tete before I got married. I was Alison Blundell. I did a bachelor's in chemistry and management science, and I went to the careers advisor, and she recommended, after doing her test, that I apply to IBM, and Dow Chemicals and ICI. So I applied to all of them, and IBM offered me a job as a systems engineer, whereby they train you, sort of over a year and a half, because I didn't have any IT experience. But they liked, chemists because of the systems thinking that's involved in chemistry, which is similar to in computing. It was the late 80s. So 88 to 91, I was in with IBM UK. It was exciting, the whole process of being selected, because they did the selection in one day. And they started with 120 odd people to begin with, and they ended up with a dozen that they gave a job to. And we were offered the job at the end of the day. So by the end of the day, you knew you had the job. And the job involved, the training initially involved doing a lot of just reading and then going to workshops and role play, an awful lot of role playing. I was associated to we were each associated to a senior systems engineer. And so basically we went with them to their meetings. Now we were working for DM, Distribution Marketing, which was the sales force behind the PCs. And this is just the late 80s, is just the beginning of the PC revolution. So the systems engineer I was associated to, he was responsible for several large PC dealerships that were based in London. And I tagged along to his meetings. I got fairly bored fairly quickly. I didn't really enjoy it. The office was a bit of a ghost town as well. We were working in this huge office in Chiswick, and there weren't many people there. And I was doing a lot of driving up and down to Basingstoke, because my manager was based in Basingstoke, and I rolled my car on a journey back from Basingstoke one day. by going too fast on a corner coming off the motorway. It really made me think, oh, is this really what I want to be doing with my life? And I decided not, so I resigned. Now, before I went to do my degree, I had traveled for a year. My brother was a headmaster of a junior secondary school in Botswana. So I went and visited him in this village, Malmatala, and lived there and did a bit of teaching at his school, just as voluntary work, and did a lot of traveling around. Anyway, I'd obviously fallen in love with Botswana, and even my parents actually went there, and they lived there for a couple of years too, so I had plenty of opportunity to go back and forth. And so when I decided to leave IBM, I thought, well, I'll go to Botswana and see if I can get a job there. Now, I really wasn't particularly enchanted by IT per se. And really what I'd wanted to do was be journalist. So I tried, first of all, to get a job in journalism in Botswana. But I was quickly brought up short that, you know, citizens can do that role. And I had no experience. So that was a non-runner. But the Government Computer Bureau was an option. So I went to the Government Computer Bureau and they offered me a job. But it was on a local salary, which wasn't really going to be enough to be able to rent the sort of property I'd like to have rented. So I went to the dealerships to see what they were doing. I visited all of the dealerships and ended up with I went to the IBM dealership for Business Computers Botswana. And they offered me a job in sales at the salary that I'd left IBM UK on. And that's what I went for. Now, within a couple of years, IBM, the government of Botswana, started a new development plan, 6-year development program. And within that, they had £100 million worth put aside for projects relating to computerization of government systems. Now, this was obviously a huge opportunity, and so the director and owner of Business Computers Botswana, who was himself an ex-IBMer, Ernest Zebron, he approached IBM to see if they would like to buy BCB and set up IBM Botswana, and that's what IBM World Trade Organization did. They bought BCB and it was established. Now, on establishment, they brought in a management team, a senior management team, principally of Danes, Jürgen Bier as the general manager, Per Meigind as the sort of systems engineer, Preben Jew Thompson, I can't even remember what he purported to do, and Soren Lausen, who was Per's doer in terms of writing software and setting up the schedules and all of that sort of thing. Anyway, so during this time, I was selling to the government of Botswana. Now, they had a team of consultants who were managing the procurement for the government of Botswana. So these consultants essentially became my customers. I was talking to them, taking them on site visits. When I was doing the proposal, they were writing the statement of user requirements to which I would respond in proposals for what the systems that we were selling could do. And there's a lot of business that I stayed up very late working with the team, writing proposals for that we didn't ever get. But the business that we did get was all of the Department of Public Service management business, which is implementing a new HR system. And the system was applicable to the whole of government, so every single ministry.
In layman's terms, this is the whole of the personnel system for the whole of the Botswana government.
Yes, and the performance management and everything sort of basically ran through this. Stores, supplies, they all interfaced with the system. And we also sold it to the Botswana police force. Now, because of separation of duties, they weren't in the initial tranche that covered that project. But somehow we managed to forget about separation of duties and go ahead and implement it within the Botswana police force as well. Not only that, I sold the Botswana police force the sort of add-ons that enabled them to do crime reporting. So I got to learn a lot about crime reporting systems and their drawbacks from the police force, because the Botswana police force was saying, you know, hey, the problem with this system is it's really easy to constrain the system so that people can't report certain sorts of crime. And I can remember, you know, doing my best to handle that conflict, but basically saying, oh, no, you know, you have to put in systems to make sure that doesn't happen. But that's essentially what I've found has happened to our crime reporting systems here. It's impossible to report fraud, and certainly the sort of fraud I'm trying to call out. So, yes.
Now, I mean, from what you're saying there, there seems to be quite a close relationship between the people selling these computer systems and the people doing the procuring.
Even closer than that, because after all of this, just as I left the country, or in fact when I was back in the UK, I found out that the consultants who I was selling to, who were my customers, they had all been sourced via PricewaterhouseCoopers Botswana from a company called Stibo Systems. And when that senior management team left Botswana, which was a year after startup, I became aware then that they were consultants from Stibo Systems, because I prepared the payment to Stibo Systems for their services. When they had arrived, I had been under the false assumption that they were from IBM. This was an IBM senior management team, but that was an obfuscation of the truth. So it means that, yeah, the customers to whom I was selling were from the same company that were the managers of the startup of IBM Botswana. My manager told me some intricate detail of what IBM's role in the Holocaust was. IBM had in those days the Hollerith machines, which were punch card machines. And IBM Germany won the contract to run the census in Germany just before the war. So IBM had all the data on everybody's their family history. And IBM leased all the solutions to Hitler and the Third Reich that they used in the concentration camps. So they had Hollerith machines running in the concentration camps, and the tattoos on people's arm was the code from their data card, which held their census details.
Yeah, so this was a sort of early kind of computer where a lot of the data wasn't held digitally. It was in the form of a card, quite a sort of tough individual card with little holes punched in it, which could then be fed through a kind of calculator machine, which would do basically the same job as a computer now does digitally.
Yes, yes, these are the first computers, really. And they're used for managing, much as we use them today, for managing human resources. So the very first HR systems, if you like, were developed on these 8 Hollerith machines and used with grim consequences and through the Holocaust. And IBM was also responsible for train scheduling. And they had the contracts for train scheduling across Europe. So it was they that managed the trains to enable the flow of people.
I mean, in what sort of mood and context was he telling you these things? I mean, I suppose you, when you join a big company like that, you know, you're kind of overwhelmed a bit with the prestige of being part of something big. But then, I mean, how did he tell you about it, and how did you take it?
When I first became the general manager and Carsten became my boss, he asked me then to set up an appointment to Tarapa Diamond Mine, which is a good 3 or 4 hour drive from the city. There was a delay of several months before I actually did that, but it was on that journey. So I was driving and he was telling me his version of history. When he told me all about what IBM had done during the Holocaust. I was driving up to Orapa. My manager's name was Carsten Schoenborn, S-C-H-O-E-N-E-B-O-R-N. He was based in Vienna, Austria, and he was responsible for all of IBM's operations in Africa. So he rarely visited the actual country, but he was my co-director when I became general manager and director of IBM Botswana. On this journey, he told me a lot of things, so I'll try to start at the beginning, which is where he started. He said, I'm going to start with Adam and Eve, which I found pretty shocking. He was saying how the Bible captures the history, if you like, the story of Adam and Eve and their descendants. The story starts with Eve committing what's described as a sin. It can be taken as a crime against natural law. And the Bible is careful not to tell you exactly what it is, but it gives alliterations or such as the apple, the fruit of the tree of life. He said the key to understanding what Eve's sin was is given in the Hail Mary, in that prayer. In the line, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. It equates the fruit of the womb to a baby. And that's the unnatural act that Eve committed. And with that act, she discovered that the ingestion of young tissue, young DNA, physically repairs the DNA of the imbiber. It repairs, as he explained, the telomere caps. So the new DNA that's created is younger, because aging is a result of the telomere caps becoming faulty, and so the DNA it's generating having errors, and those errors are the lines and the signs of aging. You imbibe young DNA, it repairs the DNA, and the person literally transforms into looking younger again. Now, this was the discovery that enabled her and her descendants to live as if forever, eternal. He said to think of them as a virus, a parasite, a parasitic perversion of natural law. Now, he said that it had advantages because, many advantages, and it enabled the discovery of and the development of the tree of knowledge through learning, longevity, repeated observation and developing scientific methods, and it was an accelerated process by using young tissues to prolong their life. He galloped through history, putting history into the context of that piece of information. Through time, the development of slave trade as being obviously the source that they used. It's easy to divert children out of those flows of people. Ownership of all the big companies, buying up any new companies that had any bright ideas. They could keep control of basically everything. And then when the decision was to conceal the slave trade and make it illegal, they basically concealed it within the processes of existing trade so that it could go on, but it was no longer visible. And he said that was enabled because they would act as consultants for the new systems that were being developed to, by the customs, etc., to, in order to order and capture, that sort of behavior. They designed those as well so that it could go on unimpeded. Does that make sense?
I suppose so. I mean, it's obviously a long time since you really thought about this, and it all sort of popped back into your mind around 2020. How sure are you that you've got, you know, proper recall of what he was saying?
Very sure. It's stuff I've not heard anywhere else, and things that I would never have thought of myself. He said that the Holocaust should more rightly be thought of as an industrial revolution because it was a cartel that managed it of the pharmaceutical companies, the banks, IBM, and train companies. And the context, well, he was essentially telling me that the plans were in place for it all to happen again in a fourth industrial revolution.
So that's Alison Wright speaking to me earlier this week. Martin, the concept here is a massive cartel, an enormous conspiracy, controlling people's knowledge of what's going on. But effectively, this is good old-fashioned fascism, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, of course, we think we know what fascism is, but then, of course, it's embedded with all of these commercial networks. And, you know, the role of IBM in the Holocaust is relatively well known.
The book is actually Edwin Black. He did an absolutely amazing book about all of this, which very few people know about, but about these Hollerith machines and the role of IBM in the Holocaust. But the concept here is that we're now looking at a computer system or computer systems, including AI, which is hundreds of times bigger in scale and in terms of what it's capable of.
Yes, and the same kind of domineering attitudes are behind all of this, isn't it? I mean, it's you know, the global elite really intend to run the 21st century on their terms, and that includes getting rid of rubbish people like the people of Gaza, who clearly no surplus to requirements. I mean, we are living in this age.
Yeah, I mean, it's, in a way, it sort of also links back to what Mark Hollingsworth was talking about, blacklisting, you know, so where there are people that can start to recognise the way that they're being shafted, those people have got to be removed from a kind of any sort of economic activity, and it has to be made sure that they have no roof, you know, no protection, and that they're marginalised, so they're spending their life just trying to make sure they've got some food to eat or some shelter, and they can't get involved in any kind of political way to threaten the fascist cartel that's farming their country.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's all control mechanisms of one kind or another, isn't it? You know.
Anyway, Alison also spoke to me about MI5, the House of Lords. That's what is it? Isn't her name Eliza Mallingham Buller, who apparently MI5 Annie Machon told us years ago that her nickname was Bullying Manor when she was Director General of MI5, and apparently she's now in charge of the Standards Committee in the House of Lords, and bit by bit they're dismantling these standards. So this is her current job on her Substack, is she is trying to make sure that the various crooks and criminals now being promoted into the House of Lords are held to account and that possibly prosecuted for breaking the laws to do with revealing their interests. And all sorts of crimes apparently are being committed. So, for example, you can have two or three different names at company's house that are spelt slightly differently, and it's a kind of form of identity fraud, so nobody can connect you to a particular company. Anyway, she goes into that now, which is her current work.
I don't know if you've come across this Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars document, because it echoes a lot of what you're saying about systems analysis and this whole idea of a kind of techno-slavery. But what you're saying does sort of tally with that. I think that was discovered in the United States somewhere. Someone had been photocopying it, and they found it in the photocopy, and no one really knew where it came from.
Yes, and it was found in an IBM photocopier, or at IBM, I think.
Mm. Yeah, so there are definitely some echoes in potential truth. I mean, we have to also, I think, add that Carsten could have been just throwing complete nonsense at you to mix with the truth, to see, you know, what you would believe and what you wouldn't believe. And this is a technique that these people use. But anyway, I know you wanted also to talk about your work today. So this is about not so much about the bad guys, but it's also about how we can deal with them.
Well, yeah. So what I've been doing is that I've been doing these compliance assessments of figures who are in politics, in House of Lords, etc. And what I found is that there's a couple of loopholes in the company's house system that they're exploiting to conceal interests, which, if they were made explicit, would prevent some transactions going through. So it enables money laundering, people trafficking, and terrorism funding. So it dodges the laws that are in place to stop that. So what they do is register more than one identity in company's house, and then an auditor or KYC software that's looking at any one identity doesn't know about the interests held in the other identity. Now, it can be an accident, and you never make use of it, of the fact, because it's a way of that you could conceal potentially income from HMRC, because you could send them one identity, whereas all of your other interests are in the other identity, and those are the ones you don't declare. And then the other thing that's going on is companies dissolving without doing final accounts. Now, that's a breach of the Companies Act as well. So having multiple identities is a breach of the Companies Act, Section 108(2), and dissolving companies without producing final accounts is also an offence. Now, the risk is that you maintain dormant bank accounts, or ostensibly dormant bank accounts, in that company's name that you can still use, again, for money laundering, or to conceal money from the authorities. So I've been successfully in getting several of the peers investigated by the Commissioner for Standards, the Lords Commissioner for Standards, a man called Martin Jelly. And so he's done, I think it's 5 or 6 reports on different people. They're all up on the House of Lords Complaints website. And then about 4 weeks ago, I noticed that they're about to change the Code of Conduct, the House of Lords Code of Conduct, and the changes that they're making to that with regards to the register of interest will mean that they stop having to declare their, what they term, non-financial interests, their charity interests. Now, this is where I'm finding all of the problems occurring, is quite often within the charity's interests. So the changes they're making to their code of conduct and sort of to circumvent, in some ways, the complaints that I've been raising. So, right, well, let me do a compliance assessment on all of the members of the conduct committee that have put in for these changes. And that's what's been keeping me busy for the last month or so, is doing these audits. And I've just got to the point where I'm getting back to Lord Evans. And Baroness Manningham Buller is the chair of the conduct committee. And she's got errors in her register of interest. For example, she was a director of what is now called ARC Data Centres. It was previously called ARC something else, I can't remember the name now, but she didn't update it in her register of interest. Now, by not updating it in her register of interest means that her association to ARC Data Centres won't be flagged in audits and KYC checks. And then another of the lords at ARC Data Centre is Lord Evans, and he also has multiple identities and didn't declare it properly. But then when I go and look at the directors of ARC Data Centres, well, one of the secretary, rather, the officers of ARC Data Centres, the secretary is a man called Paminda Tony Singh. Now, I knew Tony Singh. Tony Singh did all of the configurations for me, all the technical configuration of this complex hardware that I was buying for the government of Botswana. I was ordering on behalf of the government of Botswana. So Tony Singh, who worked late into the night many times with me on the phone, getting the configurations right for the equipment that we supplied to the government of Botswana for the big contracts that I did win. He is also the secretary of the UK ARC Data Centres. And the occurrence and the recurrence of ARC ARC, which is also used by the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, Sir Paul Marshall, and ARC ARK is also used by him or his co-director, McCormick, for ARC, Absolute Return for Kids, ARC. Essentially, I think I'm finding the clone company fraud is when you have two similarly named companies that you can switch transaction between, again, to dodge anti-money laundering and terrorism financing laws. So I'm pretty sure, as I'm doing these assessments of the conduct committee, our present conduct committee of the House of Lords, who've just made changes to the code of conduct that worsen transparency and conceal interest, the changes, I would argue, are breach the Companies Act. But they've come into force. They came into force on Saturday, on the 5th of April. So over the weekend, I put in complaints against Baroness Manningham Buller, and I've got three more that are about to go in. I've published the ones that I put in on Saturday, because what happens is, as soon as they accept that my complaint is legitimate, I'm then sent a letter saying, I'm not allowed to discuss it. And that's what happened to me when...
What? You can't discuss it? Why not?
Because it could jeopardise the investigation. I can't remember which section it is, but yeah. So that's what happened to me with Labour Together. I did one on Labour Together, and I couldn't publish it for about 6 weeks until he'd published his report on whichever... Lord, it was I was calling out.
Well, say something about Labour Together, because they're a very interesting little group, aren't they?
Yeah, so we'll look on my website, because I've done a full report on them. And do you know who I mean by Alliance for Responsible Citizenship? They a couple of the Labour, Conservative, it's a Conservative sort of supported organisation. So Badenoch spoke at their last conference in February. And there's a couple of others as well. But Sir Paul Marshall, that name's ringing a bell. Legatum Institute, Alan McCormack. So I feel like I'm getting close to being able to provide enough evidence to trigger police arrest. And that's what I'm asking for in this current letter I'm just working on Lord Scriven. So it's Lord Scriven that's really brought the whole piece together, doing his compliance assessment. Because Lord Scriven has been working for, in his register, in his current register of interest, he's working for the Department of Public Service Management and the Government of Botswana. So the very customer that this story started out with.
Wow. Well, look, I mean, what you're describing is actually a fascist system. It's a system of economic and digital slavery.
Absolutely. And that is the intention. And I was told that by more than one of my colleagues. My colleagues spoke very openly about what the longer term plans were, really. I didn't believe them.
Well, I mean, what would you suggest? We just throw away our computers or what?
All of our systems are infected by their needs. So that's needs, money, adulation, and young blood. So I'm fairly sure we could reverse engineer systems and remove the harm and leave ourselves with systems that can help us but don't control us. But it needs a global audit and dismantling the systems.
Yeah, well, maybe we should not be employing PricewaterhouseCoopers or KPMG to do that.
Well, absolutely not. No, they are criminal organisations. So PricewaterhouseCoopers, so as well as supplying the consultants into the government of Botswana, they were also our auditors. And if you look in IBM's annual report, even today, it says it loud and proud. PricewaterhouseCoopers has been IBM's auditor, has been honoured to be IBM's auditor for over 100 years.
God.
Yeah. So
where would you suggest just sort of the most interesting stuff this week people can find?
So look at my website, alisonwright.substack.com.
And have you got any closing comments from a sort of almost like spiritual point of view about all this?
I mean, the information I've just said, it rocked me. I was brought up Catholic, and I went to a convent and was practicing most of my life, well, younger life, until I didn't have to. I believe that we're naturally good. And our systems have been captured by people who are committing crimes against natural law. And that's why a lot of the harm that we see in our world is happening. I'm certain we can stop it. Absolutely certain. And we can do it through the law. I urge people to investigate. Check who they've voted for. Look their name up in Companies House. Do they have multiple identities? What are they associated to? If you find an issue, write a letter of complaint. It gives us more agency. And as the evidence builds, it'll become a tidal wave. It'll mean that we can clear out these criminals from our systems. Basically, yeah.
Okay. Alison Wright, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay.
So, bless her, Alison Wright there, trying to do the best in order to winkle out some of these crooks and criminals. And so you've got two sides to all of this, Martin, really. One is her experience with the use of IBM in Africa to control entire countries, infiltrate, spy on, effectively, run their police and army and civil service. And I suppose they don't stand much of a chance, do they, with IBM in everywhere?
No, I mean, this, you know, we live in an exploitative system, and it's always good to have people who know how it works briefing you about how it actually works.
Brilliant. I think she's done an amazing job, and also she's looking at today. But, I mean, you said for many, many times that you think that the Russian police started going, throwing away a lot of their computers, and they're using paper.
Well, I mean, not the police, we're talking about the intelligence services.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the idea is as soon as something's on a computer system, it's hackable. Someone can get at it, you know, and without too much trouble, actually.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, back in the day, the Stasi definitely used paper. And they didn't. And, of course, if you've watched the Other People's Lives, which is a sort of drama film about that era, they could tell people because it was a control situation in East Germany. So they could tell which typewriters had been used to print which whatever it was. Yeah, so they know who'd done it because they know which typewriter they're using. But of course, the people didn't have access to the kind of high tech we've got here. It was a very low tech setup. But it's obviously going to be the case that these tools of surveillance are being used for surveillance.
It's not just surveillance, though, isn't it? It's control, it's political control, it's economic control. This is a fascist Fourth Reich-type system that she's describing. She's quite happy to say, yes, it is. But is it beatable?
Well, I mean, I often mention the Taliban in this context, but I'll mention the Maoist rebels in Nepal. They were able to seize power, not completely seize power, but through a democratic election they became the government. And, of course, in large parts of Nepal there is no electricity. So all of these things won't work there.
And over to Patrizia now. Ode, the anger phone, Don's Way or the Highway of Death and Destruction. I'm not sure about that. Maybe Don's Way is the Highway of Death and Destruction. We shall see. Trump's phone is ringing off the hook. Each choice you make, come hook or crook. Press 1. Ukraine, a game of lies. Death, deceit, white powder pies. Putin, hatred behind the scenes. Stop the war, a madman's dream. Money laundered while men lie dead. Escape the border, £20,000 said. Press 2 for Gaza. Lux seafront scheme, high-rise hotels, but ignore the screams or children lying dead in piles or families burnt or bombed sky high. A deal be done to move, displace. If you don't agree, then phone replace. Riviera of blood, last breath. Genocide, seafront, no less. Press 3 for tariffs. If deal, accept. Or economics. Destruction set. The rich get richer. What a wheeze. Then buy up slumped out of stock with ease. Tariffs mad, no sense they make. Advice from the imbeciles Don takes. For billionaires, another scam. Destroy. Look sad. Clean up. The plan. Press 4. A trade war you will get. Wise guy Trump now off all bets. A bust up, punch up, destruction rules. His anger seething. What a fool. Be right, his might. His go to word. Let loose advice from those absurd. All want is rack and ruin. Come, Don Trump, no more a smoking gun. Press 5 to weaponize the call. The state of deep where many fall into a trap of gotcha lad where opposing views all seem as bad. The FBI will do its thing where death traps wait or lies will spring upon those who disagree, agree with us vis-a-vis on all our evil plans and tricks or end up dead or in the nick. Press 6, The wall in Mexico, paid for and built by those who know, living life in Mexico. A stick to beat, tie up and haul, our border rules in front for all. On plane, a photo op in chains, but no criminals on board. How strange. Press 7 for all the land we steal. Greenland and Panama a deal. Canada, perhaps, an idle threat. But deal be struck, an open bet. What Don wants, or perhaps his crew, will lie and cheat, this much is true. Deep state of hate, a motley crew, advise the Don of what to do. If after listening carefully of number choice you disagree, with executive orders, wars or lies, or double dealing perhaps despise, then hold, dear caller, for J.D. Vance, who will also lead you. A dodgy dancer. Thanks very much, Patricia. And our final clip this week is actually going to be from Michael Hudson. Martin, do you want to just say a little bit about the tariffs? We haven't really touched much on that. We did it at the start a little bit, but the point of the tariffs is it seems to reindustrialize America. Is that going to happen, or yes or no?
No, it's not. And of course, what's happened is he's stepped back from the general, apart from the tariffs on 10% on everybody and, you know, massive tariffs on China, he stepped back from the others because the stock markets were about to collapse. But of course, the stock markets then bounced back because he'd stepped back, and then they had another look at it and thought, in actual fact, once you've started this wobbling, it actually means that those who want to invest can't invest because they don't know what the rules of the game are. And if they don't know what the rules of the game are, they won't invest. And that will cause a crash, which will then set off the derivatives bomb, which will be 2008, but without the bailout.
So could Trump crash the entire world economy, like literally overnight? We find on Monday morning, yeah. Oh my God, yeah. The whole world's gone
bankrupt.
That's
right, because that's what happens. If it's going to crash, that's how it will be.
Anyway, let's hear what Michael Hudson has to say.
Trump has his own view of globalization. Instead of having a single set of rules that all the different countries are going to be subject to, most favored nation trading, he said, we're going to negotiate on a country-by-country basis. And Trump has announced his plan. America has to come out the winner on any deal he does with another country. And the new form of globalization is designed to keep the United States at the center, and he's going to deal on a country-by-country basis. Well, everybody was terrified of his the high tariffs that he imposed last Thursday at 4 o'clock, right after the stock market closed. But then he said, well, this is just my asking point. I always ask for the moon, and my strategy, Donald Trump said, is to threaten other countries to destabilize their economy. It's the only thing that America has to offer. If the United States is deindustrialized and cannot is running a budget deficit as it is, the only thing that it can do to for other countries to offer them is not to hurt them. So Trump's negotiation with every country for its tariff is, we will disrupt your trade with the United States, and that's going to lead to unemployment there. What will you give us if we don't do that? Will you let us buy some of your raw materials or maybe your electric utilities? Each country, he's going to say, we want something for, and then write down the tariffs. Well, Canada has stood up to this and said, well, we're calling your bluff. We're not going to offer you something and beg to, oh, please don't do us for 25 cents a percent tariff, because we realize that Trump's tariffs are basically hurting the American firms itself. And what he doesn't realize is how many imports the United States makes from its own firms abroad. So he's talked about Vietnam, which has some of the highest tariffs at all. Well, all the shoe companies in America, Adidas and the others, have their shoes made in Vietnam. And there's no way in which they can suddenly shift factories to the United States.
Well, he's quite right there. I mean, if Trump says we want industrialize, reindustrialize America, does he really want the rag trade and the shoe trade? Because that's what he's offering the American people. Even if he's successful, we're going to give you a job in a shoe factory. Well, I'm not sure that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
I'm not sure. What he's saying basically is, look, America has got the ability to disrupt your economy, and we are now threatening everybody around the world to do this unless you do a deal with us. And the idea is that this is really, this is his book, isn't it? The Art of the Deal. This is what he's now doing on a global scale.
Yes, and it's very similar to what the Cray twins used to do in the East End of London. You pay up, otherwise we're going to smash your face in.
And he's saying, effectively as well, Hudson, that this is really just about tax cuts.
It's not really about tariffs at all. It's about tax cuts in the United States. What Trump wanted above all is to cut taxes, and that meant basically cut government and the role of the government way back. He had he's been talking to people for years, and he said, well, you know, when did this income tax begin? How do I get rid of it? And somebody told him that before 1913, America didn't have an income tax.
Right.
It had all the entire government was funded by tariffs, and a little bit of the land sales for what was grabbed from the Indians. And Trump said, tariffs? Well, that's wonderful. Just imagine, tariffs fall on the employers, on the working class, on the wage earners. Tax cuts fall on my constituency, the wealthy class. If we can go back to the world the way it was before World War I and not have an income tax and just have tariffs, then there will be a whole tax shift off my constituency, the billionaires, onto U.S. labor. Well, you can imagine what this is going to do to the squeeze in the United States, where I think half of the American wage earner class hasn't been able to increase its wealth at all since 2008. All the increase in wealth in America has accrued, the stock market wealth, the bond market, the financial wealth has accrued to the top 10%. So when we're talking about globalization and who's doing it and who's America, this is a plan of the 10% to increase its position at the cost of the employment.
So that's Michael Hudson speaking. By the way, on RT, you know, so this is one of the things you can do on Rumble, is you can look at a load of stuff from RT, and that was Crosstalk. You may have heard Peter Lavelle there. So we got no BBC Question Time, but what we do have is RT Crosstalk. So they're doing the stuff. And anyway, you won't find Michael Hudson on the BBC, Martin, will you?
No, you won't, and nor will you find Jeffrey Sachs, who's an even more sort of establishment economist than Hudson, because as soon as you say anything out of turn, you become a person.
This is really the propaganda model, isn't it? So all this is being interpreted by people who've got a stake in this. The idea is that the world is like a kind of court of appeal. When everything goes horrendously wrong, the mass media, there is the place where some of these things at least can be discussed. But we're now in a situation with the mass media here in Britain and most of the Western world that the, you know, when there's somebody being discussed, say it's Putin or example, you've got the barrister for the prosecution, the Crown Prosecution Service is in the studio, but there's the chair where the barrister for the defence should be sitting is vacant.
Well, that's right. And of course, it then leads, of course, to a sort of feedback loop where the people making the decisions in the West haven't got the full information because they're not given it, and therefore they make mistakes. Yeah. And so, you know, if you're a middle class person in Russia with English language skills, as many of them have, they are much better informed than we are, because unless you speak Russian and you make an effort, you'll never know what the Russians think. They know far more about us than we know about them. And the same is true of China.
So I'll make sure
that's going to count in the end.
I'll make sure that Alison Wright, a full interview with her, which takes you through her career and also the details of her discussion with her boss, Carsten Schönblön, whatever his name was. I think they mostly were Danish, who she found herself, they were kicked out of Botswana, and she found herself suddenly as the sales director for the whole of IBM in Botswana, because some of the people who had been in charge were were discovered to be crooked, corrupt in some way, and had to be removed. So then that's how she found herself in that job. But bless her, she was thinking about the people. In fact, she talks about her relationship that she then took up with a friend of, or actually the Attorney General of Ghana. So she was trying to network with Africans to stop these people because she realised what they were actually up to. So that's Alison Wright. I'll put that up later on, as well as the interview with Mark Hollingsworth. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. These people are on a hiding to nothing, ladies and gentlemen. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guests. I just mentioned Alison Wright and Mark Hollingsworth. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Thanks also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from a corner of freedom near Bristol City Centre on the stream at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Christ was a man that traveled through the land, carpenter true and brave. Said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, carpenter true and brave. And a dirty little coward called Judas Iscariot, he laid Jesus Christ in his grave. People of the land took Jesus by the hand, followed him far and wide. Come not to bring you peace, but a sword, so they killed Jesus Christ on the slide. He went to the sick and he went to the poor. He went to the hungry and the lame. Said that the poor would one day win the world, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, carpenter true and brave. And a dirty little coward called Judas Iscariot, laid Jesus Christ in his grave. One day Jesus stopped at a rich man's door. What must I do to be saved? Sell all your goods and give it to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. They nailed him there to die on a cross in the sky, the lightning, the thunder, and the rain. Judas Iscariot committed suicide when they laid poor Jesus in his grave. When the love of the poor shall someday turn to hate, when patience of the workers gives away, 'twould be better for you rich if you never had been born, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. This song was written in New York City, rich man and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach what he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave.
hell, met murders and the hate of paranoia and the zenith of his power. My bed, replica, shooter, zenith dissolving. By his bed, replica, shooter. Paranoid man in his early 30s, in the zenith of his powers. When girls pass, puts head down in the street. His neighbors now are listening to this. Shakes in the chemist with buying his bits. Puts his head down when girls pass. Puts his head down when girls pass in the streets. Shakes in the chemist. Paranoid man in his late 30s. 32, 45, reaches its summit. Male, mid 30s, white, paranoia. Goes down to the dance. Goes down to the dance. Going down fast. 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 No hebe's creepers or hallucinogenics. It's the hank of paranoia. Male, white, dead to late 30s. Serial number 54129. Going down fast. Goes down to the dance. Going down fast. Serial number 5129. Leather jackets, baggy black pants. Going down to the dance, very clever. Big Thunders, paranoia man. Not as good as it was at 2:30 this afternoon. Nostalgia, spangled, late. Big Thunders, paranoia man. Going down to the dance. Going down to the dance. And troops mental inertia. Met versus man in the grip of paranoia. Just like I told you, the first karaoke. Cheap shit I've got a man. The sky calendar bar home speculates.
Here begins the 36th chapter of the Book of Job. This passage emphasizes God's justice and might, urging us to trust in his guidance and wisdom. Elihu continued and said, "Bear with me a little, and I will show you, for I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will bring my knowledge from far away and ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Surely God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne he sets them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in fetters and caught in the cords of affliction, then he declares to them their work and their transgressions, that they are behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. But if they do not listen, they shall perish by the sword and die without knowledge. Here ends the first lesson.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.
Trouble me, disturb me with all your care.
Stay.